trying to escape this futile. Who child is time to juggle is too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. To adapt in the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive in this time to wilderness. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungle specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burning slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people, we'll turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom for thy getting an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your host, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join in the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can hear us at www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. But first, you can hear us at www.timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage. Catch the live stream at that location. You can also hear us at www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening, and the live stream is playing there also. We're streaming at abitumi.com. That's abitumi.com/timeforanawakening. They stream out of Ghana, or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In that TuneIn search engine, just type in "Time for an Awakening." There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had a Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, it's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor before you leave that page, just hit that like button. It's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening media, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with BB Toomey. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. It's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight. The Time for an Awakening media. It's 6:08 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, this Sunday, May the 17th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening that will join us maybe around the 7 o'clock hour, Black student leaders from the University of Maryland, Jay Blackmore and Muhammad Salih, is scheduled to join us to talk about the Borough Cultural Center, which is the Black Student Cultural Center on the campus of University of Maryland, and tell us exactly what's going on there. I think it'll be interesting for our listening audience to hear the struggles of our young people on these college campuses. It'll be an interesting conversation with our guests. But until then, we'll be in open forum, mixing things into the conversation, and you can always join us, either talking to our guests or talking to Brother Richard by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. 32. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 6:13 on the Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, we want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum. Here in Philadelphia, 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
Hey, look, Brother Man is in his element for the day, And I don't know about the rest of y'all in Time for Awakening world, but I even got a chance to just sit outside, enjoy the heat, the sunshine, and the other part I won't go into, you know, but it's a man's thing. I'll leave that alone. Just looking forward to this discussion we're going to have tonight around, Elliot, let me ask you a question. Did you know that there was a rally in Alabama? What they call it? All roads lead to the South.
No, I didn't. I knew it was a gathering in Washington, but go ahead, finish your thought.
Yeah, it was. It's around this whole thing about the whole thing of the voting rights and whatever. And I was trying to. I heard Sister Zakiya, she did a post. Sister we had on a couple of weeks ago, and she was quite upset in the sense of, with this here voting right, the change from this that came down from the Supreme Court about, redistricting, and that she just couldn't understand, and maybe, and I can't understand either as I became aware of it, what is the strategy of going down to the bridge in Selma.
Oh, yeah, I did hear about that. But go ahead, Richard. Finish your thought.
Yeah, and as some kind of a rallying thing about it. But the thing that it was a couple of things that came to my mind. That's why I'm kind of, confused. Elliot, this whole thing of what's happened out of the Supreme Court around the redistricting, and we can see the southern states, how they're going about systematically to, even deny, I think it was one state, they even denied voting, that they were in the process of voting and they stopped it. But it's what one thing that's getting me is how we don't seem to understand how inherent this process is to the American structure and how Black folks, we really need a new strategic vision, a new strategic, plan, and a better messaging. And I'll start with this, because when I seen this and I'm listening to Sister Zakiya making her, concern about what is it going rallying down, over the Raymond Prettige Bridge, how is that going to change the power dynamics that we once again are addressing? And it makes me, think of how important it is for us to get in this communication with young people, right, who are learning about organizing around, structural, whether you call it structural injustice or just in their own, what they see is in their own interest. Because one thing I heard was, again, how they were making a complaint about how the 18 to 35, the amount, that were not participating in the voting. And I've been upset because it just, what I believe, Elliot, I can only say I believe, the LA and the Time for Wake, is the reason why young people are not necessarily seeing that this process in and of itself will give us power. Therefore, there's no reason to participate, because we're not creating a message and a strategic plan about getting power and an agenda item that we all in alignment with, compared to, because it seemed like it's the same old Black institutions that are pushing the same old rallies, and we're seeing how that is placing us in the same old position as after Reconstruction. Hopefully that was a coherent thought, but that's the reaction when I seen this all road, because I hadn't heard about it until I seen that post. So you did hear about it?
Yeah, in fact, I saw a news clip about it on the news either Friday or yesterday, and it showed, I guess, Black leaders in Alabama and maybe some of the South marching across the bridge, and you know, show protesters out there. Richard, you know, I don't believe that some of those quote unquote strategies are coming from our people. I really don't. I think they're coming from other people, even though a lot of those, the overwhelming majority of those black politicians are subservient to the people that's been paying their bills. Those strategies are not coming from out of the hearts and minds of black people. I just can't believe that. I don't know how you see it, but you know, that first march across the bridge, if you remember, Richard, the people were marching towards Montgomery because they wanted to vote. They wanted to exercise their right that they were supposed to have since that Civil War ended.
Right.
And whites were there blocking them, and they knew that they were going to be there. So it wasn't like they were surprised. You know, they knew that they were going to confront these whites. But, you know, what's the purpose in doing it now? Who are they confronting? Who's on the other side of that bridge waiting for them? It's just symbolic, Richard. Those things that I don't believe those things are coming from the minds and hearts of sincere black people, and especially grassroots black people. I just don't believe that.
The grassroots black people, I would say, I kind of perceive and agree with you. And the reason why I say that, because on one segment, you know, the quality and the demand of our lives are not even making us even aware of that this here is transpiring. And then, you know, again, I'm going to keep using, because, and I think we were talking about that, the research piece that was done by the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning, matter of fact, Dr. Henderson had sent to us, and how it laid out why young people weren't participating as far as voting. And I would say not just young people, because there's a large segment of black people are not voting. And it's because that they don't see the, you know, besides the struggle of our lives, don't see the benefit, you know. But when we get to these, the reason why I do think and I may be wrong, you know, so you know you may be right on this, that a lot of the legacy organizations, the black you know, the members of the Black Congressional Caucus, members of the Urban League, the NAACP, you know, and other institutions, why they see this symbolic reference of gathering is of some use for them, because they're talking to themselves. And what it shows is that they have not been doing no planning to prevent, so that there would be somebody on the other side. They're not even saying, who are we fighting against, to where this here thing is once again showing itself up, just like the Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. But even before that, when the Republican Party was pushing blacks out of the Republican Party because they were being effective, and when the Democratic Party was saying no blacks allowed because this is a white man's country, that we left ourselves open after 65 and thinking that what? And you've played clips where people have been saying, you know, race on one hand, racism don't exist no more in America. I don't know if I'm making sense, Elliot.
Yeah,
well, but that's why I see that they, you know, this symbolic stuff, they're continuing to do them, because other than that, they would have to be going at the structure itself.
Well, you know, what is left now, Richard, is going after the structure itself. This is where the rubber is going to meet the road. Mm-hmm. Whether these folks that the people have voted for to be leaders are going to really stand up and try to lead. Because you know, you just like Professor James Lance Taylor was with us last week and said all of these approaches have been tried, and the only one that's going to work is a nationalist approach.
Right.
Because all this integrationist stuff, it don't work. It works for the individual that's kissing these people's behinds, and sometimes it don't even work for them. But for the masses of our people, we just keep sliding steadily down. So if they're going to confront this, if they want young people and black people as a whole to be involved in that process, they're going to have to start standing up for black people. No more of this stuff about, I represent everybody and all this other foolishness. Because black people have been voting for these whites for decades. And they get in there and represent white interests. They don't care nothing about you. They want your vote. They don't get out there and fight for nothing that we as a people need unless it's going to benefit them. Just like Derek Bell talks about interest conversion. Unless they benefit from it, they're not interested in fighting for nothing that you're going to benefit from. You don't even see them out here having no town hall meetings and talking about what happened by their Supreme Court. I don't see them out here.
And that would be a part of the political education in preparing for the next generation or the generation now that is not engaged. That's why I just said, and it made me, think about how black people were organized at the turn of the 20th century. When, yes, after Reconstruction, after there was a pullback, with the Tillman-Hayes Compromise, after they white folks in the South, in the Southern states, and it's important to reemphasize, this is a Southern state strategy that is coming through the Republican Party, because they're the states that benefit. Why? Because in the Southern states, the largest population of black people exists. Mm-hmm. And they don't want them to coalesce with having proportional political representation or power. I'm not into the mechanics of it. So for those who are and whatever, but what they're saying, based off of this here, half of the black, those who are black elected officials may lose their position because of the redistricting. So isn't that about black proportion, power within the state? And I'm saying we can see this from the beginning in 1787, when they were debating about the Southern states, having proportional representation in relationship to the Northern white states having proportional representation. So it just gets me. But at the turn of the 20th century, I was, in thinking about this, I came across this, and I have to say, I said I came across it because I'm thinking, like, my thing is, Elliot, why don't we have independent political formations where we're in discussions and debates about the issues and the agenda and who will be the best representative for black folks? Because this harms black folks. Yes, other people may be harmed, but this goes after things that were supposed to benefit black folks, and this harms black folks in relationship to the political, political arrangement. I don't know if you agree with that.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
And what I came up with, one thing I came up with, I was trying to, it was like this here, African-Americans, now this is the 1900s, right? African-American Democrats. Now, you already said Democrats were blacks in the Democratic Party was very few. But they speak out against U.S. imperialism. They were a minority in a very hostile party, but they still spoke out against, they were thinking, from a geopolitical, from American nation state perspective. And it's this, and hopefully this statement will make myself clear. In this statement during the 1900 presidential election, the Negro National Democratic League criticized the Republican administration expansion foreign policy and gives endorsement to the Democratic candidate. What struck just in that, Elliot, that there were black folks who recognized that they were looking at American foreign policy. They were looking at it from a very hostile Democratic Party perspective. They were looking at where majority of black people were at. But what they had was a mechanism of their own, that Negro National Democratic League, to make up their assessment. And what they were speaking about was America's policy because of the effect it would have on black folks. And what I'm saying now is we don't have no independent structure. And I would expand that independent structure have to incorporate all the different interest groups. But we don't even, the media doesn't promote black media, black journalists, black, you know, now what's it, with a content creator, that we should be formulating political strategy, understanding from our own perspective, our own interests. I don't see that, Elliot. I don't know if I'm just rambling here.
No,
but I don't see
it. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I don't see it.
No, well, no, it was there. It was there during the time that you're talking about. During the turn of the century, you had a lot of our people that was out there fighting and with an independent view of what was going on. They didn't just buy into anything these other folks were doing. Political parties, Europeans themselves, different nationalities of Europeans, they didn't buy whole cloth to what those folks were doing. But now you don't see any independent thought, basically. They just rubber stamp. Yeah, and that goes to the control that's going on. See, it's becoming more and more obvious to people that's been watching that these people are controlled. Now, you still have folks that kind of, oh, so-and-so, he's a great leader. So-and-so, he's doing this, that, and the other. Because they're not seeing. They're not really following. They're not keeping a scorecard, so to speak. But if you're following what these people are doing, you can easily see that they're controlled. But see, now they have to say, I mean, this stuff is so blatant that they have to say something. They have to stand up one way or the other. Now, if you notice when we played those clips last week, right after the, the aftermath of that decision, you had different caucus members, and you could tell by the clips that I played and what they were saying, they really didn't know what to do. You had Bobby Scott I played a clip with Bobby Scott with a approach that he thought would have been best. You had Clyburn talking about he going to turn it over to the attorneys and all this other stuff. Like, huh? I mean, black folks didn't vote for no attorneys. They voted for him to be a leader. And he's a senior leader there. Jeffries, in the clip I didn't play when the Black Caucus was together, was talking about, well, we still got the 14th Amendment. But maybe he don't realize that they're debating right now about that birthright citizenship, which is the 14th Amendment, if I'm not mistaken, Richard. Okay. They're debating that right now, just like they were debating that Calius decision that led to Section 2 falling and Section 4 going down. So, you know, to keep holding out hope, and just like that clip I played with Dr. King, our people having faith in people that who have too often proved to be unfaithful, that approach is not going to work. That's going to get our people falling deeper into a hole.
So the question becomes how we have to politically energize ourselves. And we have been in discussion with people in different states and different formations who are, trying to address. Even, I think, it was Brother Kamal, when they had their convening, they were even raising a question about getting involved in the electoral process, right? In trying to understand, Brother Barron, and you know, we're dealing with, you know, from the point of showing how, you know, when you have a principle stand, how you can be able to be within the electoral process and serve your people. But what gets me, Elliot, when we're watching the people within these parties, whether we talk about the Heritage Foundation, when they now promoted 2025, but they've been working on that state by state since 1964.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't, you know, they, I mean, we could track the evolution of getting to what this here Supreme Court justice did. These, you know, and here at this moment in 2026, we can see the evolution of the individuals coming out of high school, going through college, preparing and developing, you know, and the wealthy, the billionaires that were supporting them to be able to get to this point where they can get back what they, you know, and what is getting back? Black folks not having or not being able to, within certain states where they have large numbers, to be able to determine the direction of that state by, you know, proportional representation. They've been working on that. And I have to ask, knowing how America is, Black people knowing how America is, why we haven't been able to put up, to be able at least to show, well, we had defenses up, but they punched holes in it. Or we had defenses up, and this is where we, you know, got counter messages. I might be speaking out of ignorance, Elliot, but I don't think that we were doing that. I think we were moving as we won, while these people were preparing to take this position using the power, and it ain't just the power of the vote, but using the power of the state in their own interests.
Well, Richard, you're right. I do agree with you largely in point, but I still put the onus on a lot of this. Listen, we share in that, but when I step forth, or you step forth, or whoever step forth as saying, I'm going to be a leader, that's a large responsibility. Mm. You just can't. When I do that, I'm not in your bracket, so to speak. When I say your bracket, I'm not saying that you're any greater than me, but the responsibility is there. So that puts you in another area. That makes me say, well, wow, Richard going to step forth and do that. You know, maybe I can kind of concentrate on trying to take care of my family or with, because Richard is doing that now. So just like that clip I play when Minister Farrakhan says that you were the watchman on the wall.
Mm.
You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye, but we're supposed to be the watchman for the people that vote for us.
Mm. Yep.
So, listen, if you're a watchman on the wall, Richard, you're supposed to be watching to make sure the enemy ain't creeping up, encroaching, and the next thing you know, they're breaking down the door.
Right.
Because if that's the case, then I look up on the wall and say, well, what the hell were you doing? Were you asleep? What's going on here? I can't turn around. I'm the watchman on the wall. I can't turn around to say, oh, Richard, well, you wasn't helping me. You're the watchman. You're supposed to be doing that. You're not out here struggling every day trying to put food on your table and provide for your family. That's what the majority or rank and file Black people are trying to do in a racist society.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have that burden on you. None of those people do. In fact, when they come out of those offices, Richard, they it's money falling out their pocket almost. They done stuffed their pocket with money.
And so that's another challenge that, you know, the evolution of that in and of itself, of how, and that gets to another layer, right? The money people, the when they want, what they want. And it comes, and it does come to, you know, the 14th Amendment, you know, later on when they started with railroads, making them political entities, to where now, you know, corporations can be able to participate. And then now corporations, could be able to have fund candidates. We're competing against institutions and individuals who have institutions that have billions of dollars to fund organizations, to fund lawyers in states.
And Richard, that shows how rotten this system is that some of these leaders keep putting faith in. Because when you do that, you know that the average person cannot compete with these organizations, whether they be religious or business organizations, with dark money coming in. You can't compete. So they always stay in control. That's a system. That's not a Republican or Trump or whoever. That's a system, whether it's Democrat or Republican. The wings of the same bird. That's a system that keeps certain people in power and always in control. Now, some of our people don't mind living on a plantation, whether it's in 2026, 1826, 1726. Some of our people, they resided to the fact, well, I'm going to be living on a plantation. But some of our people always wanted to be free. It was always in their spirit to keep fighting. It's no different now. It's no different now.
And that part about the fighting is another part that doesn't, those who fought, because, we'll be coming up on August soon, and there was a couple of months, and I don't want to push it because I'm going to enjoy the sun and sunshine and heat. But when we, acknowledge those political prisoners, some of them aged out and died in their contribution. And that's just from one generation, one segment that came to that conclusion that what you said, not in a sense of some selfish, but recognizing that the system, well, it was another could be said, is rotten to the core as it relates to Black folks. Mm-hmm. As it relates to the a large segment of Black folks. And that's why I like what, his name just jumped out of my head, who brings up about class collaboration, Gerald Horn. Because it's when your institutions and individuals are in collaboration because they can do better. Because their family can do better, because their organizations can do better, relatively. That collaboration allows for the rest to be able to lose food stamps, to be homeless, to have mental health issues, to have children moving. What the sister that came on said about from 0 to 5.
Yeah, with the early childhood education. Yes, Dr. Yeah. Emerson. Yeah.
I mean, it's when we don't have an infrastructure or thinking from that nationalist perspective, because then we have a society that says, our infrastructure that says, this is how we see, even if we're going to stay here, what we're fighting for in order to make us as a people better. Not as individuals better. Well, I got $1 million. I got $5 million. My child goes to private school. I could send my child to a computer or coding camp. It's a lot that can. And never will. Who looks out for that?
Well, it's supposed to be leadership, but that's a continuing story that'll keep evolving. Richard, the young people are supposed to join us around the 7 o'clock hour, so we'll kind of kick it around a little bit. You know, Richard, you just mentioned about, I think you said SNAP, and a lot of times we share information, Brother Maurice up there in New York, because those figures come out. They put them out around the first week or so of every month. The figures came out about these SNAP things, and the published report was in Newsweek, and another one in the Word in Black. I want to share this with the listening audience before we kind of move into another segment of the program, because it kind of deals with what you're talking about, Richard. You know, a lot of these things is happening now, and I'll use an analogy. I don't know whether it's true or not because I never tried it, but they say, you know, if you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, he's going to jump out. But if you put him in there and just turn the heat up slightly, keep turning it up, he'll boil right in the water. Well, I mean, that's the environment we're living in as a people. That's what's happening. Whether you look at the erosion of the Section 2 and Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, which was supposed to be the hallmarks of 64, whether you look at that Fair Housing Act that they take turns violating banks almost every other month, whether you look at the 14th Amendment, which they're debating now under the guise of birthright citizenship, all of these things. Let me read this, what Marie sent to me. The published report, the header says, SNAP recipients fall by 666,000 in a month. And this was dated May 15th. Enrollment in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, continues to decline following tightening work requirement rules brought in last year. New figures released by the U.S. Department of Agriculture on May 14th show SNAP enrollment declined from 42.8 million recipients in January 2025 to 37.8 million in February 2026, an 11% decrease in just 13 months. It is the latest monthly, in the latest monthly figures alone, the number of recipients fell by 668,000 between January and February of this year. SNAP is the nation's largest anti-hunger program. It provides low-income households with monthly benefits through prepaid electronic cards that can be used at approved retailers. The average household benefit stands at $354 per month. The steepest declines have followed implementations of changes introduced under the Big Beautiful Bill Act, which tightened eligibility standards and expanded work requirements for some recipients. Now, let me read this other one here, because we see that just in the month of January to February, it fell 668,000. This came out a day later in the Word in Black. The header says, hunger by policy. SNAP cuts hit hardest in Black America. The sweeping overhaul of federal food assistance is reshaping hunger in America. New SNAP cuts, tougher work requirements by state, purchasing restrictions are expected to affect Black communities most, exposing how fragile the nation's food safety net has become. For more than 10 million Black Americans who rely on federal food assistance to feed their families, the Beautiful Bill signed into law in 2025 slashed $187 billion from SNAP Nutrition Assistance Program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, over the next decade, triggering new work requirements, restricting what recipients can buy. The result, more than 4 million people, a cohort size of Los Angeles in population, have already lost SNAP since the law took effect. Hunger prevention advocates say Black Americans have been disproportionately affected, and the worst is still ahead. The SNAP benefits amounts is just $187 a month, or barely $6 a day, to supplement a household food budget. Many recipients, that modest sum is the difference between consistent meals and food insecurity. And despite the well-worn narrative about SNAP recipients being unemployed. Census Bureau data showed that more than 75% of households receiving SNAP benefits include at least one working person. The reality is SNAP is not a program for people who won't work. It's a program for people whose work doesn't pay enough. So we see here that this food supplement that people have been getting, and a lot of our community have been getting, because we don't make the money that white America and some of these other folks make. And women with children, you heard Dr. Emerson talking about it when she was on a couple of weeks with us ago with us. All of these things being cut. On the leadership's watch, they see this stuff happening. This goes to leadership, Richard. This goes directly to leadership. And another thing, too, I want to throw in while we just, about 10 more minutes before the top of the hour, and our students are supposed to join us in the, right around 7 o'clock. Richard, this weekend, now, let me kind of build this scenario. A couple of weeks ago here, Richard, the transportation secretary, and his name escapes me, was here in Philadelphia. Because he represents this Rededicate 250.
Yeah.
Freedom 250. I'm sorry. Freedom 250. And the Susquehcentennial Commission. Both of them are involved in what's happening here in Philadelphia. And he was here, and the mayor, and they went around to the different supposedly historical sites and had young white kids and young black kids acting like they were signing the Declaration of Independence, things like that.
Sean Duffy.
Now, he was here, and he represented the Freedom 250. And you have some blacks now that's scrambling for money under that Freedom 250 so they can get money for whatever organizations they have or whatever. I guess the prerequisite is that they're involved in some type of celebration of this 250th anniversary. But if you look at what's going on in Washington this weekend, and let me read a couple of paragraphs from this published report. Or the header says, Pete Hegseth to headline D.C. rally with far-right and Christian nationalist speakers. And the Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, will this weekend headline a faith rally at the National Mall in Washington, D.C., hosted by a private foundation operating in partnership with the White House, which includes speakers that experts have characterized as Christian nationalists or extremists. Hegseth, the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, and House Speaker Mike Johnson are also scheduled to appear. The lineup includes no Muslims and no representative of historically black churches. The Rededicate 250 is one of a string of events organized by Freedom 250, a private nonprofit launched by the White House in December 2025 as a partner to the bipartisan U.S. Susquehcentennial Commission. Matthew Taylor, the author of several books on Christian nationalism, said that the Rededicate 250 lineup of speakers, that they are some of the most active Christian nationalist leaders that you can find in the country. So, Richard, you got a white, basically white nationalist rally under the guise of some type of religious celebration being held in Washington this weekend and being co-sponsored by this Freedom 250, who are the same ones here that's doing stuff in Philadelphia that black people, including the mayor, is running towards to get money, to kiss their behinds and other things. How does that work? What kind of picture is that, Richard?
Hey, I don't even know how to answer.
And let me add one other thing to that mix, because you heard the lineup of the folks that's going to be there, Hexif, Rubio, Mike Johnson. Well, let's add one other to it, because here's an article from the Times of Israel. Trump's Sabbath 250 called divides U.S. Jews ahead of the National Mall prayer rally. As part of the 250 anniversary celebration of the United States, the U.S. President Donald Trump is calling on Americans to pray together in a nine-hour marathon at the National Mall on Sunday, featuring a host of Christian speakers and rabbis. But first, Trump is calling on Jews to mark the Shabbat, the Jewish day of rest, from sundown Friday to nightfall Saturday, and encourage other Americans to consider embracing the ritual as well. In honor of the 250 glorious years of American independence, and on the weekend of the Rededicate 250, a national jubilee of prayer, praise, and thanksgiving, Jewish Americans are encouraged to observe a national Sabbath, Trump said in his Jewish American Heritage Month proclamation on May 4th. So you got Jews, white nationalists, and others there in Washington, D.C., together this weekend. And I think you had a Uncle Tom. Well, I don't like to use the word Uncle Tom, because that might be that might be putting Uncle Tom in a bad light. But you had what's his name, Tim Scott there. I think he's probably the only black face there. But the point I'm raising, Richard, is you have a white nationalist movement basically in D.C. this weekend, being co-sponsored by an organization that's claiming they want blacks to be involved in some celebration here in Philadelphia. I mean, where's that? See, that's why you need media, Richard. You need conscious black media that's going to point these things out, not scared black media that's taking money from these people and afraid to say stuff on the air. Then you do your own people a disservice. You have them caught outside with no clothes on when you don't prepare our people, when you don't give them the proper information so they can protect themselves and others. Go ahead, Richard.
I just, you know, as you were saying that, Elena, and I'm focusing on the Christian white nationalists, you know, and their involvement in this celebratory aspect of, you know, 250 years since the founding, when they talk about the Declaration, you know, because the Christian white nationalism has always been there, right? And they're celebrating, they acknowledge them. Matter of fact, I did see briefly in passing, you know, they were showing, they were at some cathedral, and the Republican Speaker of the House was speaking. And I intentionally, for the, you know, brief time I was looking in the audience, and I have to say, I couldn't find a black face. And I know that's not a scientific approach, but I couldn't find a black face in the panning of, you know, that audience in that moment, in that snapshot. But the Christian white, could you imagine the language of a black Christian nationalist formation, even talking about, you know, could you imagine what the propaganda language would be about for one that promotes itself as a black Christian nationalist? But what we see here is not that they just have the ability to say, as you say, to give money or to have a private, because what you read is Freedom 250 is a public-private initiative. So it's private people putting up money too in order to promote their Christian nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Christian nationalism, when we talk about, especially in the South, those white hooded people, you can't tell me. And those in those churches weren't Christian, white Christian nationalists that were preventing black people from voting, that were running out of black people, were burning and hanging black people. And that's in that period. And we're talking about now, you know, when we're talking about prisons, we're talking about drugs, we're talking about white Christian nationalists. I'm just saying, just by image, imagine a black Christian nationalist getting public image in the media and propaganda system as it is. Would it be considered something to be raised up and celebratory, or would it be something that would be denigrated as a threat? I think it would be a threat, Ellie.
Yeah. Yeah, you know it. Yeah, you know it. In fact, during the last years of his life, I guess they labeled Dr. King as a black Christian nationalist.
Yeah. And it's so because we see in those states, in those southern states, and they don't have to be in southern states, but in those southern states, they are, they have political power, and it's those, and they are representatives in the political infrastructure, and they are the ones that have voices that has to say that the proportional representation, or, you know, what they used to say, not many black people can be able to gather in one space. Isn't that what proportional? Breaking up the districts about black people, you're not allowed to congregate in one political territorial space. So we got to break you up. Why? Because you become a threat. I don't know if that'll work as an analogy, Elliot, but that's when I hear that and I see that, that's the concern I have.
You know, before we take a brief break and then bring the young folks, some of the students on. Let me play this clip. It goes to when I played that clip by Bobby Scott last week, when they were kind of reaching for a strategy to try to fight back, and he mentioned about shutting things down. See, that should have been a strategy that was used, but you've got some leaders who don't want to do that because they don't want to seem militant. They don't want to seem nationalist. So they didn't employ that strategy. But you heard when I played that clip by Bobby Scott last week when he was saying that might be a strategy that they might use. You remember that, Richard?
Yeah.
Well, let me play this. This was Akeem Jeffries on a news program last week. And I want to thank again Maurice for sending me this. And then we're going to take a break and bring the students in on this conversation. Richard, let me see if I can pull this up. Listen to what this former representative says in reference to how people need to approach this.
Yeah, I expect that it will, but we have to be honest about the realities of these deep, deep, deep red states is that they are not unorganized or not uninterested in voting. They are suppressed. They are intentionally and optimally suppressed. It's been a 60-year game by the National Republican Party. We're talking about 2013, Holder versus North Shelby County, North Carolina. We're talking about the elimination of Section 2, the elimination of Section 5. We're going all the way back to a generation of adults who are seeing their manifestation of wanting to erase the voting rights gains of 1964 and 1965. So that's not something that's fixed in one election cycle. cycle because of anger. Here's what does fix it. If I could look at the camera and talk to my good fat brother, Hakeem Jeffries, you have to be willing to, once you get the gavel in January, you have to be willing, Brother Hakeem, to hold the chamber hostage to say nothing moves until we pass the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And Democrats have not been willing to burn it down ever. If he had done that 5 years ago when Nancy Pelosi had the gavel, we would not be in this position and we would not be in a situation where Section 2 was now taken. Because remember, Section 5 was taken a few years ago.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Democrats have to translate voter anger into using the authority they have. Shut it down, Speaker Jeffries.
Richard, before we break, now, you heard him say that they weren't willing to do that 5 years ago when Pelosi, when they had the House and Senate. If you remember, that was during the time when the first John Robert Lewis bill that they're trying to repackage it. When the John Lewis bill was out there, when the George Floyd bill was out there, and when black farmers wanted the money that was due to them, that was promised to them by Biden, the $5 billion to go towards some type of reparations, not nearly scratching the surface, but it was money promised, and they got none of it. And the black elected officials didn't burn it down then. Mm-hmm. Well, see, now you done painted the people that you represent into a corner. Now, let's see what happens. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, the black student leaders from the University of Maryland will be joining us to talk about the Nuburu Cultural Center, which is the black student cultural center at the University of Maryland, and the things happening there at the cultural center. I think that you'll be interested in this conversation. You can join the conversation always by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. IBBToMe.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now at bbtumi.com, at bbtumi.tv, at bbtumitv.com, at bbtumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
A new era, a new phase of the struggle, where we have moved from a struggle for decency, which characterized our struggle for 10 or 12 years, to a struggle for genuine equality. And this is where we're getting the resistance, because there was never any intention to go this far. People were reacting to Bull Connor and to Jim Clark rather than acting in good faith for the realization of genuine equality.
Do you think white people in this country, and I'm talking about non-segregationists, people devoid or thinking they're devoid of racism, do you have any idea of what they want the Negro to be in America?
I think the vast majority of white Americans will go but so far. It's a kind of installment plan for equality. And they are always looking for an excuse to go, but so far.
And know that this problem needs to be solved, and we can't keep relegating it to generation after generation because a few of us got a little money, a few of us got positions, a few of us have wealth, while the masses of our people are going steadily down. No one man can rise above the condition of his people. The brother said responsibility. Is it that we should let them take responsibility to do for us, or should we pool the knowledge that's at the table, the power that's in our community, the wealth that's in our community, to change the harsh reality of black life in America? We have to do the job of fulfilling the black agenda. Thank you.
Whites are expert game players in their contests to maintain absolute power. One of the time-honored gimmicks is to point to individual blacks who've achieved recognition. But look at Ralph Bunche. Think about Lena Horne or Marian Anderson. Look at Jackie Robinson. They made it as one of those who has made it. I would like to be thought of as an inspiration to our young, but I don't want them lied to. Name them for me. The examples of blacks who made it. For virtually everyone you name, I can give you a sordid piece of factual information on how they have been mistreated, humiliated. Not being able to fight back is a form of severe punishment.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. As I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 7:13 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening, glad to have the students here with us, the black student leaders from the University of Maryland, representing the Namuro Cultural Center. We have Sister Jade Blackmore with us. Brother Muhammad Shali is with us. And I think Sister Anissa is with us. She wasn't supposed to be, but I think she's here. Let me know who is with us. Brother Muhammad, is this you?
Oh, yeah. Hey, how you doing, man?
Good, good, good. Sister Anissa, is this you? Sister Anissa?
Hello, this is Anissa.
Okay, and do we have Jade? Is Jade with us?
Highly blessed and highly favored to be here.
Is Jade? Okay, great, great. Everybody's here. I'm thank you. Thanks for being with us to kind of let us know. And Sister Lisa, I didn't know you were going to be with us because I knew that you were traveling, but I'm glad that you are with us. Before we kind of go into what's going on down here in the University of Maryland on campus, and especially with the Nimbiru Cultural Center, give our listening audience a little background on yourself, what you're majoring in at the University of Maryland, before we kind of talk about what's going on the campus. And if you don't mind, Brother Mom, we're going with the ladies first. And that's...
No, I don't mind.
Let's go with... I think Jade is up here first. Let's go with Sister Jade, then we'll go to Anissa, and then we'll come to you, Muhammad.
Thank you so much. Hello there for all y'all listening. My name is Jade Blackmore. I'm a proud Washingtonian from the great city of Washington, D.C., and I currently am a junior environmental science and policy major at the great University of Maryland, College Park.
Okay, and you can go a little further if you want to, Sister Jade.
Absolutely. I'm also a proud member of our campus's SGA. I am the agricultural representative. I'm a proud worker at the Nimbiru Culture Center on our campus, as well as an active member of my school's chapter of NCNW, the National Council of Negro Women.
Okay, okay. Sister Anissa?
Hello, good evening, everyone. My name's Anissa, and I'm a senior at the University of Maryland. I'm currently studying agricultural economics, and I've been a part of the Nimbiru Ambassador team for about 3 years now. And, yeah, I'm just really excited to be here. Thank you.
And Brother Mahal.
All right. Hello, everybody. My name is Muhammad Sali. I am a public health science major at the University of Maryland. I'm a senior. Started working with the Nimbiru Ambassadors recently when I realized how dire the situation was. You know, they put me onto game how a lot of things were going. And I noticed a lot of disregard and disrespect towards Black people on the campus. And so I joined the fight, you know, that brought me here.
Okay, now I want you, all of you, to kind of help our listening audience to understand Nimbiru, what it means to you as a Black man, young Black man or Black woman, what it means to the students that use the facility. And just give us a little background on Nimbiru. And then talk about what it means to you before we kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what's going on there. And we can start again with Sister Jade.
Okay. At least for me as a Black woman right now, Nimbiru was such a safe space for me. You know, not many people know, but the University of Maryland is a predominantly white institution, so that's a PWI. And I was so scared coming from my beautiful chocolate city going into Maryland. I was worried I wasn't going to be able to find other brothers and sisters around there who were, like, equally as open-minded and ready for change. And I was just so happy to discover Nimbiru my freshman year. I was lucky enough, and I was able to find it my freshman year. And it was if this beautiful, cool breeze just swept me off my feet. You know, coming from D.C., going into University of Maryland, I didn't really know a lot of people. You know, typically everybody has been with the same friend groups they've been in with since high school, middle school, elementary, et cetera. So going in, I didn't know anybody, and I've been able to meet some of the most amazing people, some of the most talented people ever. And the Culture Center is truly a third space. You know, in our current culture right now, we don't have enough third spaces to where people can relax and find community outside of just work or schooling. So to me, Nimbrew is my home away from home. You know, every time I get sad, even though I technically work there, it's my third place I love to go to relax, see my friends, get some advice from one of our older staff members. It's truly a great place. Thank you.
Sister Nisa, talk about the Nimbrew, what it has meant to you, how you were exposed to it when you got there, and just to give us a little background on your relationship with Nimbrew.
Yeah, so I actually transferred to the University of Maryland the beginning of my sophomore year. So similar to Jade's story, I grew up in the DMV, but I was hoping that when I had gone to college that I would be able to, like, find a new group of people and not have to, you know, rely on old high school friends. But I really wanted to find a community of like-minded people. So one of my friends had told me, oh, you should go visit the Cultural Center. I know they have a lot of events at the beginning of the semester. And I was still looking to make new friends and meet new people. So I went to their Welcome Back Week juke joint event. And Nimbrew juke joint event is basically when we have different students sign up to perform different art. So we have students performing poetry, rap, singing, musical performance. So I attended that, and that's where I was introduced to Miss Ann Reese Carswell, which is the associate director of the Nimbrew Cultural Center. And from there, I connected with her, and she told me about the Cultural Center and what it offers to students on campus. And I was there pretty much every day for the first 2 weeks of school until she was like, oh, I'd love to offer you a job here at the Cultural Center. And it's been amazing ever since. I've met a lot of really strong-minded and passionate students through the Cultural Center, students who are passionate about social change and uplifting the Black community on campus. So, yeah, ever since then, I've just been really passionate about upholding the legacy of our Cultural Center and making sure that we maintain it as a safe space for future University of Maryland students.
Okay. And Rilla Muhammad?
All right. So what Nimbrew has meant to me, so I'll give a little context. So University of Maryland, the school we go to, is predominantly white institution. So it's majority white students, you know, and then we got Black, you know, Asian, Latino, Latina, and then all that. And so Nimbrew, really, when I first got to the university, I was very confused on where to go. I definitely had a large culture shock. I'm a PG County resident. I grew up in PG County. And so it was definitely a large culture shock going from all Black, you know, and Latino PG County schools to going to a PWI. So when I found Nimbrew, it was like a godsend to me. Like, I finally felt like I could connect with other people in the space, you know. And it got to the point where, you know, I had dropped out earlier in my first couple semesters because I had no support. You know, Black men in higher education, we have a lot of unique barriers. And so I was dealing with a lot of those. And Nimbrew really helped me to break those down, you know, and put me in a community with like-minded people. And it really helped me, you know, it really helped me do better in my studies and take my education seriously and see myself in that space. So, you know, that's what it means to me, that community, that looking out for each other, you know, that's what it's all about, you know?
Okay. Now, I want all three of you, in your own words, to kind of, and take as much time as you need, to kind of talk about what's going on there and how you're viewing it from your perspective. And, you know, before we get into, like, some of the demands of the students. But let me say this first, because some of you might not have been at the university when the Supreme Court ruled against affirmative action, because that's basically what a lot of these attacks are around. I think they kind of mask it when they talk about DEI, and that's involved to a degree, but it's really around affirmative action. And the suit at that time, when the Supreme Court struck down affirmative action, it was dealing with university admissions. But we see that it has expanded and took a life of its own because it has went into the workforce and everything else. But a lot of these attacks, especially on the predominantly white campuses, was around that decision. Funding's cut, money is cut, programs are cut, and cultural centers is being attacked, such as yours. So, again, talk about Nemburu and what has been going on there. Educate our listeners, and like I said, you don't have to rush. Take as much time as you need, and you know, think about some of the things that you really want to express. And again, we'll start from Jade.
Sure, no problem. You know, what we're seeing right now, and thank you so much for touching on it, we used to have a DEI department on our university, but after the Supreme Court did that, the name was later changed to the Department of Community and Belonging. And what we're seeing right now is blatant disregard and disrespect. You know, that's been our tagline as we've been going throughout this movement on campus, as we've been doing this fight. Our tagline has been, your disregard is visible, because it's not just disrespect. It's a blatant disregard, and just as if what we've been seeing right now on our campuses, we've just been seeing the university see how much it can push us and how much they can take away and how much we can still function with that little of what they give us. And it's truly disheartening to see that, because Nemburu has been on our campus for, I believe, 53, 54 years as of this year, because it was founded in 1971. And it's so, just so sad to see a university where this culture center is one of the first culture centers on our campus, just see the university just have a blatant disregard for it, despite all that it does, you know, despite it being, you know, the Black African Culture Center on campus. So many different groups, clubs, and organizations use it. You know, we have the Muslim Student Association that regularly meets every Friday. We have so many Black and brown, white, like so many people of different races and ethnicities that use the center. So it's just disheartening to see the university just not care as much as it should, you know, like for the tours that they have, you know, every freshman who goes into our university, what we have is that they do tours. And like essentially a tour guide will take those students across the campus, show them all the important landmarks, are the major features. And Nemburu wasn't even added to those tours until this year. So what we're seeing is a longtime institution on campus that's right next to one of the hearts of campus, you know, the Adele Stamp Union, just be blatantly disregarded and disrespected as if it isn't one of the backbones for culture on the campus. That's truly what we're seeing right now.
Okay. Anissa?
Yeah, kind of building off of what Jade said, as we'll discuss later, but the vice president of Belonging and Community referred to Nemburu Culture Center as the crown jewel on campus. But what we're experiencing is the exact opposite of that. We have an extreme lack of funding. You know, the infrastructure in Nemburu is, to put it quite frankly, very underdeveloped and poor. You know, our stage in the multipurpose room is being held together by tape. Our microphones don't work. So when students come and use our facilities, you know, they always have to deal with broken, you know, equipment. And we used to have a tech facilitator, someone that would, you know, set up all the technology for the student events, like the Promethean board, the projector, the different microphones. But that position was removed from the Culture Center. So now it's up to the students to do those things. And a lot of us don't have a lot of experience in that field. So, you know, we're constantly being put on the spot to help fix these issues when in the past, we had people to help fix them for us. And then also, like, in the wintertime, it's super cold. In the summer, it's super hot because the AC and heating don't work. The couches have been there since before Jade or Mo and I have been born. The carpet is extremely old. There's mold stains in the ceiling. So, you know, when we hear the, you know, the Department of Belonging and Community refer to Nemburu as the crown jewel, but then you look around us, we kind of just think to ourselves, you know, your words don't really match your actions. So that's kind of what we've been addressing and fighting for, to help, like, maintain this space on campus for not only Black students, but the other students that use it as well.
and Brother Muhammad.
Yes, thank you. I think I would speak to a deeper frustration with our administration, particularly Dr. Georgina Dodge, who has been claiming to be an advocate for Nimborough while simultaneously making decisions that are actively dismantling the cultural center. You know, and we could get more into that. For example, like the refusal to renew the interim contract of our current director, Dr. Psyche Williams Forson, which is very loved by the community. But we've really been dealing with a lot of, you know, like manipulation in regards to when we ask, we having meetings, you know, we're talking to the administration, we're telling them about our needs, and we're constantly being deflected or minimized, or we're being hit with political tactics of, you know, oh, it's not in the budget, oh, personnel matters, and we can't discuss this. And you know, we're dealing with a lot of manipulation from the administration, which I think is particularly alarming to me. You know, I mean, the other buildings in the campus, I mean, they're brand new, renovated, new furniture, all these plugs and water fountains. And you know, Nirenberg, like they said, our stage is held together with duct tape. I mean, pretty much all of the major Black organizations on campus use our cultural center and our facilities, you know. But it's just completely underdeveloped. If you even walk into the next building over, you can see the difference. And a lot of Black students don't even know about Nirenberg. And I didn't figure out about it until the second semester of my junior year. And all of these things are not just coincidences or things that could be written up. All of these things are intentional things that have been done as a result of these anti-DEI, you know, push from the Trump administration and the overturning of affirmative action and things like that. We've been steadily been dealing with them kind of snuffing us out with policy over time and using these political tactics to confuse us. You know what I mean? So I won't go on too long, but yeah.
Richard, jump in.
No, I'm going to be asking questions that kind of like really to get to know this challenge as a part of a broader challenge. And so I need y'all help on this. I was looking at the numbers. I seen that University of Maryland has 13.6% of the student population is Black or African American, which is interesting because you hear that in relationship to the broader society. I guess my first question for y'all is this, and Brother Muhammad, I think you kind of touched on it as far as your awareness, but how has the, since y'all been there, what is the students' population engagement, Black student population particularly, engagement in the center? Is it something that's been around since 71 and people don't know about it? Or is it something that's been around since 71 and people know about it, but because they're engaged in other things, the things that you are speaking to, they're just not, it doesn't come on their radar. What's the impact of the center to the broader Black population that goes to University of Maryland? And I'll start with you, Brother Muhammad, if you don't mind.
Oh, I'll pass this one to Jay because I feel like she would love to answer this question.
Go ahead for it.
Oh, thank you so much. Chivalry is not dead, y'all. It is not dead. but what we're seeing right now is Nimborough has been an active part of our college's like cultural life since it was founded. But recently we've been seeing an issue, especially after the pandemic, that a lot of those relationships that would have been passed down, as you know, like people, like older people who have been at the college for longer, they take in some freshmen, they take in sophomore, take in transfer, saying, hey, yo, these are the spots, here's where the community is. But we're seeing that kind of falter off despite us still having a large amount of students that do come. It's there isn't that level of communication. As I stated before, the university isn't marketing us or showcasing us in the way they showcase other culture centers. You know, in our meeting with President Pines, I asked him when truly was the last time he set foot in the culture center. And from my understanding, that was fully over a year plus ago. That was at the time of our meeting with President Pines, that was over a year plus. He said he was there at the time of our meeting 3-4 weeks ago. Mind you, there's always student workers there who are working the front desk who have to let people in. I asked all of our workers, pictures. They said we had not seen him. He said he was there to visit one of the staff members. I asked one of the staff members. They said, oh, he did not come to visit me. I don't know why he said that.
Was somebody else going to respond?
Oh, no, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering, because it seemed like it's a summer camp. Is there a community collaboration with the center as far as students, community, activities or programs or events?
Oh, yes. Not only does our center, like our space, specifically our NPR that Anissa mentioned earlier, not only is it open to the general public, but every year during the summertime, NMBRU hosts an annual summer camp from grades 2 to 12, and it goes from early June to early August. So there's definitely the community involvement. We always have alums coming in who say, oh, yeah, I graduated 10 plus years ago, but I'm coming back because I still love the center and I still love the mission here.
And I'll just stop with this one in relationship to, okay, now I guess I'm not clear. At what point did the activism to really protect the center become, to y'all experience, become more engaging, is now more active than another point? I know that, I guess I only heard one that was a senior. I don't know how long you've been there, but is it more active now than it was, say, 2 years ago, as far as relationship to the center?
If I may, I believe that the Cultural Center has always been thoroughly engaged with by the student body population. The thing is, we've just been seeing kind of numbers dwindling or interest kind of dwindling because of the lack of facilities and the lack of resources in the center. You know, we can't, like, host large events. And it's interesting that you asked that because, you know, the Cultural Center would definitely, in the previous years, was in a state where there was a larger Black consciousness at the university. You know, in 2019, you know, Dr. Dodge, the same person that's causing an issue now, got into controversy for, you know, attempting to push out the director of the Cultural Center at that time. And, you know, and at that time, there was lots of students outside. You know, there was hundreds of students. I'm not sure if that was 2019, but there were times where basically the student activism has kind of dwindled down to the point where we're realizing that this is kind of intentional by Dr. Dodge, because she's been in heat ever since she got to the university for trying to, you know, tamper with things. And, we used to be able to have homecoming events and stuff like that right outside of Nearham Borough. And, like, as time goes on, they come up with these reasons why we can no longer have our event right at the Cultural Center. Like, through policy and stuff like that, or through confusing narratives and things like that, where they say, oh, well, it's too much money, or, you know. So those are the kind of things that we deal with. And I can follow up more specifically if you have, like, a follow-up question. But
I'll turn it back over to you, Ellen, and hopefully you'll be able to come back as I get a handle on, because I'm really interested in the how Black culture is being challenged. Right? And that's what I kind of hear. I just want to, you know, come back to that from y'all eyes. Is it cultural Blackness that's being challenged? Or is it I hear the renaming, the Department of Community Involvement, or is it just it's not inclusive enough because of the cultural products and the cultural activities that are going on? Is cultural Blackness being challenged at the University of Maryland or by this particular director that you're speaking of? That's the thought that's framing right now for me.
Okay, so I think that's a great question. I'll take that one. So yes, I do believe that the Black consciousness and the Black population at UMD is being intentionally targeted. It has been over time. The reason why I didn't find out about Nearham Borough until my junior year is because of the lack of unity within campus. I mean, there have been times where, you know, when you're a Black person under, you know, a white supremacist system, you're divided. You know, there are these things that, there are these invisible barriers that divide you from other Black people. For example, you size other Black people up, or you being one of the hyper visible and invisible at the same time. You know, these are especially at, like, a PWI, you know, and I feel like in my experience, like, Black unity was just, is just not there. Like, that Black consciousness, I've seen it in the past. I've seen students rally together in 2019 against Dr. Dodge, the same lady giving us problems now. I've seen hundreds of people, you know, come out. And then over time, we've seen the support for the Cultural Center dwindle, and we've seen our resources be taken away slowly more and more through policy. And, you know, and we 100% believe it's an attack on Black consciousness, because whenever there's any anti-Semitism or there's any attack on the Jewish community, the president and the administration are quick to condemn anti-Semitism, and they're quick to promote and encourage support of all these other different things. But, you know, if you, all you have to do is look, walk into the Nirenberg Cultural Center, and you will see the difference in the priorities between ours, between how they, what they want for the Black population and what they want for an and what they're willing, what they want for another population. For example, maybe like the Jewish population. If you go into their cultural center and go into ours, you're going to see a huge difference. And it's all because of Dr. Dodge. And you know, she said some crazy stuff in meetings over time, which I feel like is really important to discuss, like with the type of things that they censor us in the meetings will really give you some context, you know, and I'll pass it over to my colleagues for that.
Go ahead, Anissa.
Kind of building off of what Mo said, for example, about, I think it was in the middle of March, the New Brewster ambassadors, we organized a protest, and we messaged, direct message via Instagram as well as via email to over 40 different student organizations. So this is the Black Student Union, Caribbean Student Association, African Student Association, NAACP, and as well as other multicultural organizations as well. And we reached out to them saying, like, hello, like, we know that, you know, you guys are community members of UMD, and you guys, not only that, but you guys also use our facilities on, like, weekly basis. You guys are regulars here, and we would really appreciate it if you guys would be able to, you know, take at least 30 minutes out of your day to come and just support the Cultural Center and, you know, just stand with the Cultural Center. And the day of the protest, the first protest, we had anywhere from 40 to 50 students. So that kind of just shows you that, you know, the lack of community, like the lack of Black unity on campus is very present, you know. And when typically for like a Black student union meeting, there can be anywhere from 60 to 70 students. And there was about 3 people present from the Black student union at that protest. And, you know, different students, not to name drop, I'm sorry. Maybe I should have been so blunt with that, you know, different students from different organizations who use the Cultural Center on the daily or weekly, you know, we messaged them directly, and then they only had one representative present at the protest, or they didn't even show up. And we even had a student worker drive past on an electric scooter, wave to us, and wave past us at the protest, and then keep on his way. So, you know, there's just a lack of prioritization, not only from the university administration, but also from the students as well, because I don't think the students understand that, you know, this is an important space on campus for you as well. Like, you know, this is a place where you use to congregate, and, you know, this is where you've made your best friends. This is where you've made connections. This is where you, you know, learn different things. And, you know, you constantly are taking from the Cultural Center, which is fine, because at the end of the day, that's what it's there for. The Cultural Center is there to provide for your students. But at the same time, you, those same students should be able to, you know, give back to the Cultural Center, you know, feedback into it as it has, like, given to you. So, yeah.
If I can, Elliot, I just want to ask Jada as a follow-up to that, her perception to what Sister Nasir brought up. What do you see as the reason for the students, the Black students who are utilizing or have been utilizing the center, especially as it relates to this protest? What is it that you see is the reason for the lack of action? I'll just stop there. What is it that you see is your perception?
Right. Thank you so much. Honestly, like, when I was talking, like, let me figure out my words here because I want to make sure I say it correctly. But
right now we're seeing a lack of action because everybody wants the center to pour into them, but nobody wants to pour back. And I feel like that reflects a larger issue that we're seeing right now in the Black community, not just on campus. But everybody wants a village that benefits them, but nobody's willing to be a villager and help someone else in that sense, if that makes sense. You know, it was really disheartening to know, especially people who came, you know, they come to the center on regular, they come for the free food, they'd be coming for their meetings, they have 300 people plus. But yet, when we reach out to them saying, hey, could you please come? It's really important. It's really important. Nobody comes. But when we come to them later, they said, oh, we didn't hear anything about that. And then we're over here confused because we talked to your president. We talked to the previous president. We emailed you multiple times. We messaged you privately. We talked in the group meetings that you're a part of. Yet we're not seeing people show out. And it's so disheartening because I love Nimbaru. You know, and that's not just because I work there, but because I'm a student who's able to appreciate how important it is for Black students, especially in this current political and economic climate, not just in this country, but on campus, to have a third space, to have a safe space where they can be themselves without the scrutiny of white supremacy, like being over their shoulder. And right now we're seeing right now with the culture is people don't want to go out and support. People don't want to actually get out and protest. People aren't understanding that liking an Instagram post or sharing it on your story isn't just enough. We need you to actually show out. And so many people don't understand that when it comes to protesting and fighting for your rights and fighting for your community, it's going to be inconvenient sometimes, but not a lot of people are ready to actually deal with inconveniences.
Well, what does that say to you, Elliot? Well, that sounds like the broader Black community, don't it?
Yeah, you know, and that's what. Let me kind of travel down that path that Richard started. Because I've seen a Zoom meeting that the students had, Muhammad. In fact, all three of you were part of the meeting, and Muhammad spoke about the tension of the Black students seeing the injustices on campus, but not saying anything about it. Talk about it from all three of your perspectives. Do you think it's fear there, or just a not caring attitude and ambivalence towards what's happening? Do you think it's, you know, and the reason I'm throwing fear in there, and Richard, you got to help me with this, because when the war with Israel against the Palestinians broke out, we had students from several universities come on, Black students, and one of the students was from the University of Maryland. Do you remember his name, Richard?
No, I don't.
I'll have to look back. Because this was about 3 years ago, Richard?
Yeah. Of course, maybe two. Let's say two.
Yeah. And after they were on, I do know that there was attacks on them in the media and from Homeland Security. One of the students was a exchange student from the continent, and his visa was going to be revoked. You know, and that kind of that harkens to a plantation mentality. When you had one of our ancestors that wanted to run off or run off and was caught, they would bring him back and beat him before the rest of the people, our ancestors at the plantation, to strike fear in others. So do you think it's fear that some of your colleagues, your students, your brethren and sisters don't want to be involved in these things because of fear?
If I may take this question, I believe it's fear, but I think it's more so apathy, like more so if this doesn't affect me, you know, so I'm just not going to care about it. I think it's also a lot of people don't really realize how deeply indoctrinated they are into white supremacist patriarchal ideals. People don't realize that throughout time, like, you're constantly being fed information by social media and algorithms that information is not being picked by you, it is being picked for you, you know. And I think everybody's afraid of being like the one gazelle that strays off from the pack and then gets made an example of. But the point is that you have to trust in the community to take care. That's why that community has to be there, so that we're not going to let nobody be picked off, you know. But if we don't trust each other, then that's what's going to happen. So I think it's a general apathy of like, well, it doesn't affect me. And it's also burnout, you know. It's like, I have so much on my plate. That's what a student is thinking. I have so much on my plate. I have finals, I have work, I have, you know, everybody is so overwhelmed with like just the cost of living and just like trying to make it, that people feel like they don't have time for these kind of things, you know. But these things is only going to get worse if they don't become more politically aware, so that the cycle repeats itself, you know. And I'll pass it on.
Wow. Sister Jade or Sister Anissa, if you wanted to weigh in, then I'll pass it back to Richard.
I'm sure I can. To add on what Muhammad said, it definitely is an issue of apathy. You know, yes, while we do have some people who are definitely scared because they don't want to necessarily rock the boat because of fear of what might happen to them, but it's also a serious issue of apathy. You know, a lot of people, especially in the Black culture right now, don't care unless it's directly impacting them. And even when it is directly impacting them, people don't want to start fighting until the boat's already sunken, you know? People are saying, hey, yo, there's holes in this boat. We got to fix it right now. We got to fix it right now. But everyone's all like, the boat hasn't sunken enough for me to care yet. And everybody wants to start replacing bricks in a house that's already burning down, if that makes sense, you know? Mm-hmm. Instead of asking why the house is burning down, everyone would rather critique the different bricks that are holding it up. And that's what we're seeing right now in the Black community, you know? We're not all on the same page. And that's why I feel a lot of us have been struggling, especially with this movement on campus.
And do you see that this is an unfair question? I'm going in unfair question territory, y'all. So push me back if necessary. But because y'all are students, y'all are the ones who are, and I heard a lot, or at least a couple of you mentioned about environmental studies. Do you see this as an extension of the community, the broader Black community, this apathy, or is this just a part of the generational, this generation that your cohorts that you're a part of? And let me back up with this thought that I have, because if I'm not mistaken, what you're describing too, as far as the infrastructure of the center itself, goes beyond, the deterioration goes beyond your generation of students. So let me ask that, because that seems more poignant. Does the deterioration go beyond your the generation of students who were at the University of Maryland before y'all came? Were the condition of the center, the plant, was it deteriorating based off of your understanding, and needed upkeep and a level of activism against the administration to get the funding to do the upkeep? Or is this just something happening that has been happening since you've been there?
Oh, I can definitely take this. You know, it's been happening for so many students, like even years before me. Like when we first started this, we've gotten in contact with so many different alums, so many different workers who are at the center years before us, saying, hey, thank you so much for doing this. We had fought as long as we had been at the university, and then we graduated and we had just hoped that someone had picked up the mantle. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely, I feel, listen here, my people of my generation are going to hate me, but I feel like it's definitely a generational thing, you know. Our generation has become kind of numb. You know, we're the generation where school shootings were happening on the regular, and we had, of course, we had the pandemic. I feel like my generation has kind of grown numb to the chaos, to where we're just like, oh, I'll wait till it's more serious. Oh, I'll wait till it's more serious. Wait till it's more serious. You know, previous generations before us actually got out and protested and fought and, you know, pushed against the government and institutions. But our generation right now, I'm not saying we're not fighting. I'm just saying there's this amount of apathy where it's just like, oh, bad stuff is always happening. I'll get to it when I get to it kind of mentality.
Based off of your experience, Anisha, would you say the same thing, or your observation is about, you know, that it's just something within this generation, or based off of what you know or perceive?
Yeah, kind of building off of what Jade said, I think that we live in a really interesting time. You know, my generation, we grew up with social media at our fingertips. So, you know, we had unlimited access to the internet. And with that came, you know, a lot of desensitization to a lot of, you know, bad stuff on the internet. You know, when you scroll through Instagram page, one thing will be a school shooting, like Jade said, the next thing will be graduation photos. You know, people just scroll past it like it's just another, you know, just another Instagram post. So I think that has to do a lot of, that has done a lot of damage to our generation, because, you know, to everyone else, they're kind of either subconsciously or unconsciously, you know, numb to it and desensitized to it. And they're kind of just like, okay, it's another, you know, another bad thing in the world. Let me just move on. I'm going to just keep pushing, just going to keep doing me and things like that. So I think that moving forward, I think it's going to take a lot of realizing and kind of rewiring your brain to realize that, you know, we're purposefully being fed this graphic content, you know, a lot of the horrible things that's happening into the world, so that when horrible things happen to us, we're kind of just like, oh, it's just another day. You know, this is normal to us, when in fact, this is not normal. Nothing what we're seeing on social media, the bombings, the school shootings, people starving, that is not normal. That is not normal to be witnessing at 7 a.m. in the morning when you're eating your breakfast and scrolling through Instagram page. But, you know, this is all intentional. We're being fed this information. So then, again, when it happens to us, we're, you know, it's just another day. So, yeah.
Hey, Elliot, I want to ask Brother Muhammad whether this, you know, based off of what the sisters are saying, you know, because I kind of hear the same thing that's happening in the broader community. I don't know if you would agree with that, Elliot, you know, but what I don't hear is the impact of the administration of the University of Maryland also creating this kind of environment. And that's a thought that I have, because we talk about social media and how it is stimulating us, you know, not to be as active in our own interests. And I'm wondering, is that also with the University of Maryland as an institution? And you mentioned a couple of times this particular director, but is that the intent compared to what I hear other centers, cultural centers or interest group centers? They seem to be getting the funding. They seem to have engagement, and they don't seem to have the same challenge. So is it intentional? What you think, Brother Muhammad?
Yes, absolutely. I like the way you phrased that question. And yes, I absolutely think it is intentional. I think a perfect example of how we can see this as an intentional, one of the biggest reasons why this whole thing started was because of the termination of our, like, current interim director, Dr. Psyche Williams, Force's contract. She was supposed to continue with us for, like, about another year, and they shortened it to end at the end in this August. And so this is one of the major catalysts for the reason that we took this political action, because it is completely unfair. You know, there's nothing wrong with Dr. Psyche Williams Force on paper. Everybody in the community loved her. But we believe that it was a purposeful, intentional decision by specifically Dr. Georgina Dodge, who holds the authority to, but simply chooses not to. And when in our meetings, when we talked to Dr. Georgina Dodge about renewing Dr. Psyche's contract, she said no, because simply she does not want to. And then she said anybody who disagrees with the decision to with her decision about Dr. Psyche's contract can kiss her A word. You know, and she said that directly to us in an official meeting on record. And we dealt with, you know, disregard from President Pines of saying that we were just one of hundreds of organizations who refused to publicly reaffirm us, even though he has publicly reaffirmed the Jewish community via email for less. You know, and we've called him out for this, and we're met with dismissal, and we're met with, you don't understand. And they don't let us have staff present at meetings. The one meeting we had at the beginning, we had a staff member present who was calling them out for all of the misinformation they were spreading. And after that, they refused to have us meet with staff members anymore so that they could intentionally manipulate us. And so I'm saying this example to say, if they are capable of disrespecting us to our face like that, if they're so confident and cocky to tell us to kiss their A word when they know that we're passionate about this and we're extremely upset about this and we want Dr. Psyche back as our director, I mean, what does that say about how they really feel about the black community on campus? You know, and it's other intentional things like them snuff, you know, I don't want to take up too much time, but them snuffing us out over events that we planned and giving us a hard time and neglecting the cultural center and just leading us on. And you know, there is no black community, black consciousness is not taken seriously and valued at University of Maryland, even though it sits in Prince George's County, a predominantly black and Latino county, but it's a Zionist institution. It's a Zionist institution with white supremacist influence that's completely snuffing out the local black population, you know, and the administration is completely complicit in that. They, you know what I mean? They're entirely complicit. Matter of fact, they are the ones who are initiating and being aggressive with that policy, because people don't understand that policy is violence. And the policy that has been enacted on the cultural center by the administration is absolutely intentional. And that has been reflected in sentiments by Dr. Dodge and President Fonz.
You know what, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, I want to talk about because I don't follow like the hierarchy there at universities, who is over what, but I want to kind of go into, especially this Dr. Dodge, to kind of get a little bit more familiar with who she is and what she's trying to do, whether she's acting on her own or acting in concert or being instructed to do what she's doing. And then we're going to talk about the other folks that might be able to help, and have they been doing that. And when I say the other folks, I'm talking about leadership. Me and Richard was talking about leadership before you three joined us. So we're going to travel down that path a little bit, and just to pick you guys' brains to talk about more of this situation, because this situation is not just happening on the University of Maryland's campus. It's happening on several campuses around the country, and some of them might be HBCUs. We'll talk a little bit about that when we come back from break. You can join us in this conversation too by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for an awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Escape the digital plantation. IBBToMe.com, IBBToMe.TV, IBBToMeTV.com, IBBToMe.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. IBBToMe.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI. Black Power. ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometiyu Black family, to join your interconnected Kometiyu Black communities. Escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
It does not profit black people or poor people anything to have the vote and not be able to select the candidates who they want to choose. Now, how can you choose between Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Agnew, Wallace, and Humphrey? There is no choice. Evil is evil. There's nothing in between that. I think the vote can only be used as a tool of organization. We can only use the vote to organize our people. Now, to really believe that we can put someone in office and that these people would be responsive to our needs, it's naive, politically naive. Because even if one of the black candidates who ran for office was to take the office of president, then black people must be prepared to fight against that person.
Why?
Because, you see, the system mandates the action of the individual. The individual does not determine how this country will function. This country works off the military-industrial complex, which means that it's profitable to wage war. And unless you, you know, devise another plan, another scheme to sustain, to boost this economy, then it's going to be necessary to wage war. Whether, you know, a black individual is in office or a white individual is in office. Well, we're talking about a complete a change in system.
The system is rotten to the core. That's why every time we have had a presidential election, whether it's white or black, you always have to choose between the lesser of two evils. So you either vote for Satan or the devil, and you catch hell with either one.
And this included comedians, comics, trumpet players, baseball players. Show me in the white community where a comedian is a white leader. Show me in the white community where a singer is a white leader, or a dancer or a trumpet player is a white leader. These aren't leaders. These are puppets and clowns that have been set up over the white community and over the black community by the white community, and have been made celebrities, and usually say exactly what they know that the white man wants to hear.
One black man believes in violence, one believe in integration, one believe that one day after we all marry white women, we'll all be a light brown color and there'll be no problem. One believes that if we get enough politics and education, we can take over the country and be the mayor and the president. One believe, such as I, that separating on some land will solve it. Cleaning up our own neighborhoods, respecting our own women, and doing something for ourselves and quit begging white people. This is our solution.
You know, we really are being colonized. In a colony, the education is controlled from outside. The politics is controlled from outside. The economics is controlled from outside. The police in a colony are not there to serve and to protect, but there to keep the colonized ones from disturbing the status quo. The question is, do we want to continue to live as a colony, or do we want to be like the original 13 colonies and decide that we've had enough? Let's break from a colonial past and let's seek
freedom.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:07 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening, conversation black student leaders from the University of Maryland, Sister Jay Blackmore, Brother Muhammad Salih, and Sister Anissa is with us. Talking about the Demboro Cultural Center, which is the Black Student Cultural Center at the University of Maryland, and the attacks being waged against the center and against staff. Again, any questions or comments, you can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Sister Anissa, Sister Jay, and Brother Muhammad, let me kind of preface my question by saying this, because you, all three of you, spoke about the administrator or the person, Dodge, that's waging these attacks against the cultural center. And I asked the question before break whether she's being directed to do this or whether she's doing this on her own, because I didn't know the hierarchy of the universities and her position there. But let me say this, because what's going on there might be symptoms of a larger problem. If you look at, and Richard, you remember, I think it was during Black History Month at Florida A&M University, where the black students wanted to do some programs there, and they printed literature with the word black and Black History Month, and they were attacked by the I think it was the dean of the university, a black woman, about putting the word black. They had to use an acronym at Black History Month. They was using BHM because she attacked the word black being used. But after the student stood up, she kind of relented and backed off of her stance. Here in Philadelphia, maybe about a month ago, the Ghanaian president came to Philadelphia, and he wanted to go to Lincoln University to acknowledge the contributions of Lincoln to Kwame Nkrumah, who was the president that brought independence to Ghana, and his influence here by being at Lincoln University, joining the UNIA here in Philadelphia, and being a member of the Garvey movement, and how it made an impact on him and the country of Ghana as a whole. And they wanted to acknowledge him there and give him the honorary doctorate, but it was blocked at the university because of Ghana as a nation's stance against LGBTQ. So his invitation to the university and his the honorary doctorate that was going to be given posthumously to Kwame Nkrumah was blocked. So it shows a larger influence on college campuses, whether they be black or predominantly white, with the use of administrators that look like us against young people as yourself or anybody, whether it's an instructor, a professor at the university that's speaking truth to power. These attacks are being waged against them, and they're using people that look similar to them or look just like them to wage these attacks. How are you viewing this with this Administrator Dodge coming after Dr. Psyche, maybe some of the other instructors there, with the purpose of maybe even shutting down the cultural center? How are you looking at this, and as opposed to maybe the analogy that I just gave about the larger attack against the blacks at university campuses?
So I'll start with that. I think that this decision by Dr. Dodge does reflect pressure from the Trump administration and also just her superior. So President Pines, the Board of Regents, you know, and honestly, if we're being real, you know, Jewish donors, or not even Jewish, just like Zionist donors that have a large stake in the university, which really it plays a large part in what they prioritize and who gets what, you know. And so I believe that this is definitely reflective of pressure from the administrators above her, but I believe it's also of her own accord. I believe that, you know, Dr. Dodge, I mean, she's been adversarial to us, so I'll speak quite frankly. I believe that, you know, she is indoctrinated, you know, heavily personally, you know, herself into white supremacist ideals. And I believe that her attack on Dr. Psyche is personal, you know, or I feel as though she refuses to do this because of her own agenda, you know. And if I'm not answering your question as directly as you'd like, I could elaborate if you have a follow-up. But
No, you gave a direct answer. But if you want to, you know, listen, when y'all answer, take as much time as you need, because I really want you to expand your thoughts. I want the listening audience to hear exactly what's going on there and exactly how all three of you feel about what's going on there. But go ahead. You can pass it on.
Okay, I'll wrap it up and I'll speak plainly too. So, yeah, I definitely believe that Dr. Dodge has a personal agenda against Dr. Psyche. The ultimate authority to renew Dr. Psyche's contract lies with Dr. Dodge. It is her decision, and she absolutely refuses to. Even after multiple protests, even town halls, we've contacted the county executive, Aisha Brayboy. We had a meeting with her. We've reached out to the Maryland State delegates. We reached out to the Regents Board, and she's really holding hard into not renewing the contract. Because essentially, like, if they don't, the reason why this is so important is because if Dr. Psyche's contract is not renewed, then they're going to in place another puppet director, you know, somebody like Dr. Dodge or somebody like that, who's just going to reinforce the system even more. You know what I mean? Like, so who is going to reinforce the white supremacy and reinforce the neglect even more? They're going to put somebody who's going to be complicit in whatever policy they have. That's part of the reason why they don't like Dr. Psyche, because she advocates for the community and she advocates for what the students actually want, what we actually need. And when they come to her with some type of policy that doesn't make sense, she challenges and she pushes back and she said, this is not going to help. And so they ultimately became frustrated with her. And that's after Dr. Psyche, you consistently pushed back on a lot of agendas and policies that they had in place for the cultural center that would make it worse quality for the faculty and the students. That is when we received the news, you know, around early April that she would not be getting her contract renewed, you know? So basically, to summarize that, I would just say, it's definitely a personal agenda. I definitely think it's something deeply within her, like something deeply conservative, something deeply racist within her. But I think it also just reflects what she's been indoctrinated into, which is the larger administration, which has this heavy Zionist white supremacist influence from the money that it's receiving at the university.
Yeah. Okay. Sister Nisa or Sister Jade?
In my personal opinion, as Muhammad said, it definitely feels as though it is a personal agenda. In our meetings with VP Dodge, you know, the head of community belonging, she has continuously given us false information, and then we work off that information. She spreads this narrative that we're misinformed students who don't know anything. When we first met with VP Dodge, she told us that the decision was not up to her in regarding the interim director position, and it was truly up to American Studies. This is because our current interim director, Dr. Psyche Williams-Forson, isn't just any person. She's also a staff member. She's a professor in the university. So, and when she is our interim director, she's only there for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And because of that, she's technically part-time, and that we're borrowing her. Community and Belonging is borrowing her from American Studies. After that meeting, we went to the American Studies department, and we asked around saying, hey, we would like her to be our interim director. Can you all sign off on this? What we learned from that is that the decision was not up to American Studies and that it was truly up to Dr. Dodge. When we met with her again, she told us that, yes, the decision is up to her, but they don't have the budget. When we talked a bit more and we went to American Studies, we found out that is also not the case. Community Belonging does not even pay our current interim director's full salary. Since she's only part-time and being borrowed from American Studies, Community and Belonging only pays a small portion of her paycheck to keep her there for those certain days. And then when we went to her again, she told us that Dr. Psyche doesn't want the position. We went to Dr. Psyche. Dr. Psyche said, I actually do want the position. Finally, after all of that, when we finally got an opportunity to sit down with President Pines, the head of our university, he told us point blank period that the decision was purely up to her. And she said it's because she purely does not want to. And we told her, hey, that doesn't make any sense. Because for a director position of a culture center like this on campus, it typically takes a full academic year. So that's a fall and spring semester and the breaks in between. But Dr. Dodge is trying to get rid of our perfectly capable interim director who is doing her job perfectly to replace her with a different interim director, only to say that she wants to fill the position of permanent director by this upcoming fall semester. That objectively is hastily. She says she cares about the center, but with the haste that she's doing, that doesn't prove care. This kind of position takes a full year to do. You're trying to do it in under a month or so, especially because UMD has recently done a hiring freeze until July 1st. And when we came to have back and forth is when, as Muhammad stated earlier, she said that statement of saying that those who disagreed with her could kiss her A-double-S-S, which was very disheartening to us because that reads as a personal agenda. If we keep pushing saying why, and the best you can give us is that you don't want to and those who disagree with you can kiss your blank because you're retiring in 66 days, that tells us that's a personal agenda. Even when we met with President Pines again, he said that the reason why Dr. Psyche's interim position was not being extended, it was not a personnel issue. That means that there is no overlying issue as to why it's not being extended. It is purely up to Dr. Dodge. And she has said multiple times, I love Dr. Psyche. I'm the one who put her in that position, da-da-da-da. Then why are you trying to get rid of her when the people are crying out saying, hey, she's doing her job? So as I said, that feels to me like a personal agenda. If you can't give any other reason other than you don't want to and that people who disagree with you can kiss your blank, that tells me there's a personal agenda here and that you have some underlying issue with Nimburu as a whole. Because she wants a puppet there. As Muhammad said earlier, she wants a puppet. She wants someone who's just going to do whatever she wants. Mind you, she's retiring. How that works is beyond me. Why you want to put a puppet in that position, even though you're retiring, tells me you want to go full scorched earth, and you just want to see how much of a mess you can kick up before you go. But that's just my opinion on it.
Sister Nisa, you want to weigh in?
Mo and Jade kind of touched on it. I don't really know what else to add. They did a pretty good job summarizing that.
Okay. Let me ask this before I pass it over to you, Richard. Because I've seen some of the clips of the protests held outside the cultural center and some of the students involved and the things that you guys are saying, the chants and things of that nature. Have you reached out to any of the representatives, and I'm talking about political representatives, in the area of the school, or being that that's a state school, I guess you could reach out to any of the representatives to get their assistance in what's happening at the university?
Oh, I can actually answer that. We, like the workers there, have in fact reached out to the Board of Regents, Maryland State delegates, county executives. Like, we've definitely been reaching out and talking with them, with seeing what they can do and where we can go from there. And what I can say from that, because certain things are still being fleshed out, is that they are trying to schedule a meeting with President Pines to essentially say, hey, the students have brought these concerns to us. What is it possible for you to do?
Okay.
Yeah, and I can add specifically to who we've contacted. So we've been in contact with County Executive Aisha Abrebu, who's expressed sympathy to our cause. Right now we're waiting for her to follow up. We've asked her to call a meeting with President Pines. We've reached out to a few Maryland delegates, specifically Speaker Pena Melnick, Delegate Phillips, Delegate Martinez, and also Senator Washington. There's a couple people that we've reached out. I think two of them are the Black and Latino caucus chairs of the delegates. And we've also reached out to the Board of Regents, who claim that this was beyond their jurisdiction when it's not. An important thing to note is that the president, the Regents Board, and I believe even the Maryland State delegates all have authority to overturn this decision by Dr. Dodge. You know, so that's why what we're in the process in right now is communicating with them and getting them on our side and getting them to put pressure on the president and Dr. Dodge. So, you know, it's either we get pressure, we pressure them to make her change her decision, or she changes her decision on her own. Because, you know, if we get this puppet leader in Nirmboro, you know, and they're just going with all of the whatever policy that they give them, it's the future of Nirmboro is not looking good. You know, I mean that instability in leadership, that gap in leadership, of stable leadership in a period where we're already experiencing such instability. I mean, to sentence Nirmboro to that, you know, signals a clear disregard for our ability to prosper. So.
Okay. Richard. Sister Nisa, did you want to say something on that?
Yeah, just that we are, you know, currently still communicating with local and state politicians, and those that have reached back out to us, they are in full support. I could speak on County Executive Aisha Brayboy. She is a Maryland alumni, and she also frequented the Nirmboro Cultural Center during her time in undergrad. So she's very much in support of our cause, and she's, you know, reaching out to her colleagues and things like that and seeing what could be done.
I'm thinking out loud, y'all, again, so bear with me as I formulate this and getting your feedback as it relates to you as future leaders, and, you know, and you're demonstrating that in taking on this task. We appreciate the work that you're doing, and you, as, you know, engaged in being able to see that, you know, possibly see that this is a broader thing, and I'm working through this. When it was raised about the funding, I kind of Googled, and I'm looking at the amount of money that is coming to the University of Maryland, and bear with me for a minute. The largest donor, University of Maryland, is A. James and Alice B. Clerk, which gave a historic $219.5 million. This transformative gift, one of the largest ever given a public university, primarily funds need-based scholarship, graduate fellows, and infrastructure for the engineering school. And because these other major university benefactors, Brian Irby, the Oculus co-founder and alumnus, has contributed $30 million, primarily established a state-of-the-art Bremer Tribe Center for Computer Science. The Brim family, Google co-founder Sergey Brim's family, including the parents and brother, has donated $57 million to establish the Brim Mathematics Research Center. Steven Swartwort, a 1977 graduate, pledged $18 million to the university. And then it's Bob and Carol Baker, with a combined estate, committed $10 million. I'm raising this because it seemed a lot. Even when I looked at Daryl Pine, the president, a lot is going to the technology and engineering. And I wanted to ask you, because the center is centered coming out in the 1970s, the heart of the Black Power movement, the heart of Black cultural identity, Black cultural pride. You know, the center, that generation was you know, felt it was necessary to have something, an institution that reinforced that. Do you see from these gifts and from the de-escalation of culture and humanities on the institution and the escalation of engineering and science and technology, do you see that with this kind of money coming into the university, even having it looks like Daryl Pine is of a darker hue, or maybe an African American descent. Vice President, what's her name? Dodge seems to be, you know, lighter, but possibly of African American descent. Do you see that this transition from the humanities and cultural identity and to engineering and science occurring on the University of Maryland?
Yeah, so I can start with that. So I will say it is very noticeable. I will say this, certain buildings, I think there's a very large inequality. Like, you can tell which buildings are computer science. You can tell which buildings are, you know, those heavy STEM buildings. Like the Brendan I. Reeve Center, this huge new building, like at the front of the university is a computer science building and the engineering. And yeah, I do see that shift happening. And if I may take it a step further, I think I know why. I think that UMD's one of their primary things is computer science, but I think overall UMD has come under criticism a lot for partnering with weapons companies that are actively contributing to genocides in Gaza, in Sudan, in Congo. So, you know, they've been under fire for this for a long time. And I think one of the reasons why they emphasize this is because that they are very tightly knit with the war industry. You know, they receive a lot of donations from Lockheed Martin, a lot of stuff like that. So I think that UMD has kind of made partnerships with these companies to funnel students into the war machine to kind of, okay, because a lot of students complain about, oh, well, the only place I can find a job is at defense contractors and stuff like that. A lot of these computer scientists that are graduating are running into an ethical issue because they don't want to work for a defense company or a weapons company. But that's what UMD is getting a lot of its money from, is by supporting these Zionists and supporting these weapons companies. And that's why a lot of the focus is, okay, let's do computer science. Let's focus on what these people need, and let's take away from the humanities or the culture or the history, you know, the things that are important to the Black community. And, you know, and eliminating our history, particularly for the Black community, is particularly harmful because our history carries such significance, you know, and without knowing our history, it's like not being equipped, properly equipped, especially at a PWI, you know. So yeah.
What about you, Jay? Do you see the change, Jada, and the effect that may have on the cultural, especially African American culture, reinforcing in students coming there? Do you see
I definitely see a kind of change. It's something that I can honestly describe as we're being pushed to no longer rock the boat, like I mentioned earlier. I feel like we as a culture, we had our moments and we had like our major events where we fought for causes that were true to our hearts and we did all this. But recently, especially with our current generation, there isn't that push anymore. You know, everyone, like, we're more so being pushed to keep our head down and just go with the flow, don't create a ruckus, which definitely speaks to like the growing cultural issues surrounding of how society expects Black people to move, especially in the corporate space. You know, our generation's being very much pushed right now to just be silent, just go with it. You don't like it, but just as long as you get your paycheck and you can survive the day, that's fine. But we're not really being pushed or allowed that moment, like those spaces for us to fight, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And I do have, Ellie, I do have a follow-up, and it goes to out of the discussion about Prince George in general, but do you have any thoughts in relationship to the transition that your campaign is also a campaign in relationship to the transition from cultural, African-American cultural specific, which also would provide you having a principal stand in relationship to whether it be the military industrial complex or even where technology is going, on the University of Maryland campus? Do you see a shift in priorities since you've been there?
100%. During my short time here at UMD, I definitely witnessed, a strong push for the hard STEM majors. So this would be like the engineers and the computer science majors to kind of funnel those students into working for defense contractors. And even those within the business school as well, because I know that there are some companies that view the University of Maryland as a target school, and they will go there. They'll send representatives from their company to go speak at the University of Maryland to help, entice students to come, whether it be through a bonus or this and that, come work for our defense contractor and we'll give you this much as a starting salary and things like that. But even more so, tying back to the point of social media, I think that, a reason why a lot of people from our generation don't really feel the need to speak out can also be because they're worried about maintaining their quote unquote image. And this extends further to their online image. There are some people who might think that, posting about what's happening in Gaza or in Sudan or anything that's happening globally on their Instagram could be cringy or, oh, my friends aren't posting it and I don't want to be the one person to post it and then they'll look at me funny. So, a lot of it has to do with people not wanting to be seen as the outsider or as the other. That's a huge part of it. No one wants to be the other. But, when we're talking about systemic issues like this, we're at the point where our community has completely been brainwashed to think that what's happening is normal. And it takes, rewiring and realizing that, what's happening is not okay and that you need to make a step forward towards, realizing that being pushed towards one sector, like the defense sector, is not the only option. Being pushed to work for Lockheed Martin is not the only option, that there are other ways to, make a livable wage and to, earn a paycheck without having to set aside your morals.
Mm. And Ellen, I appreciate you being patient with me also, but
you should add a follow-up
to y'all, but because y'all also raising, we were talking about this earlier, because as I'm listening to this campaign, and again, y'all need to be commended because you heard, you've given reasons why others may not take up something that's critically important, and that being a institution that is to be able to be a part of the community itself in general, and also to reinforce that sense of belonging, right? But that sense of belonging to a people and a social consciousness. But y'all are also, I think a couple of you mentioned you're in from the D.C. Prince George area, and I have to ask you this: Do you perceive, so I'm just asking for your view that this what we might talk when you're saying it, your generation itself in relationship to what might be the drivers, but to the broader community in relationship to the importance of a center like this, do you see that, perceive that there's a lack of, from the Prince George County community, the DC community, that centers like this are vitally and valuable to the development of young scholars, technicians, African people like yourselves? Do you see that the social consciousness of the need for the support for a center like this is a part of the consciousness of the Prince George and general community itself, if that's a fair question?
Anybody? Yeah, I think that's a fair question. I would like to take that question. What you say makes me think about the fact that UMD, I mean, I grew up in PG. UMD was 10 minutes from my house. You know, it's classified as in-state tuition. It's a great school. It's kind of hard to get into, but it's a great school, great quality education for a good price. You know, people don't realize that this is an option for them. You know, in PG, you know, UMD is kind of like sheltered from the rest of PG County, like even down to the way it's infrastructure is, like everything's like separate. It's like a little bubble outside of PG County. And, you know, even though it's right in the heart of PG County, you know, it's kind of socially treated as like something separate. And a lot of PG residents don't even engage with it or don't even go there. And I think that is intentional. Like I think it's all intentional. I think when I first went to the university, I noticed the vibe was off. I noticed that it was all white people. And I just feel like it just makes no sense because this is such a strong, like black county. And at one point, the richest county, right. Black county in the nation at one point, and it's still up there. And so it's this university should reflect the black population that is immediately next to it. Why is there such a disproportionate amount of black and Latino students at this university when it sits in a predominantly black and Latino county? You know, that is unacceptable to me. That shows something intentional. You know what I mean? And I think that overall, there's just a lack of even awareness of the cultural center. And because it's so hard to build those connections and to get people to care about the university, because the university doesn't reflect the broader Prince George's community of black and Latino students. You know, it's like a lot of it is like continuously over and over again catered to the comfort of white students and to the comfort of students who choose to assimilate more than other students, you know, and it creates a problem in getting that engagement, that social consciousness from the surrounding community, you know, and
yeah, I appreciate that. What about you? What about you? And either one of you, your thought as far as the broader, you know, community itself, having the, and I like the term that you use, Mohammed, the cultural competence to know the value of the center. Do you perceive that the broader community has that cultural competence, or is it like the students of these, you know, on the campus, that these black cultural organizations on the campus that have people that participate in it but don't necessarily wish to advocate for it? Any thoughts?
I can definitely talk about that. It's definitely a situation of people come, but they don't necessarily understand why it's important, if that makes sense. I know we talked about it a bit earlier with this kind of apathy. It's where people, we as a culture have been fighting for so long that we have taken for granted or forgotten the importance of the little things that make up community, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's what we're seeing right now with the center, especially in the way that the university isn't willing to promote it or showcase it as it does its other culture centers. The university, I feel, definitely has taken it for granted. It doesn't understand the importance of it. It doesn't understand that, hey, we're not just a long-standing culture center just for kicks. We actually do something for the community. We actually supply the community with something. And the community recognizes that, but at the same time, they kind of have forgotten to a certain degree just how important these spaces is, if that makes sense. Mm. It's kind of how in our current culture thing where we, like, living in the 21st century, especially, like, as Americans, we get used to these certain privileges, not understanding that, hey, yo, people in other countries don't have it like this. You know, for instance, we have access, like most of us have access to clean running water at just like any time we want. That isn't the same. I feel like that is kind of relates to the situation we're having now. It's we've gotten used to these spaces that we've kind of forgotten the importance of them.
Mm, very well. What about you, sister? Any thoughts on the contents of the broader community, cultural, you know, competency in relationship to the importance of the center and the work. And I'll add for you, the work that y'all are doing. And I know you have to, as students, you have to be focused, as it was said earlier, on a lot of other things you have to do. That's why y'all need to be commended. Elliot talks about leadership all the time. But do you see the broader community that the, you know, see the value of the center, or is it just like the students within the student population, Black students in particular, know it but don't see the value of supporting it? What's your thoughts on that?
I'll say that the students that I have spoken with, they do understand the importance of the cultural center because, A, they either go to the cultural center themselves, or B, they have friends who go to the cultural center and they've heard of the type of, you know, events that are held at the cultural center, or just like the type of community that's there. But outside of that, you know, immediate, that circle of Black students who are aware of the cultural center, not a lot of people on the University of Maryland's campus know about the cultural center at all, which is actually really funny because it's located directly next to the student union. So when people go on tours, it's clearly, you know, it's, they stop past it, but it's not talked about on these tours. So, you know, there are a lot of students, and I have like a couple of friends who I tell them, I'm like, oh, I can't do this. I can't study right now because I have to work right now at the cultural center. They're like, oh, what's the cultural center? And I have to explain to them, oh, you know, the building right next to the student union that you go to get your Chick-fil-A lunch. Yeah, that's the cultural center. And we've been here for like 55 years. And, you know, I have to explain to them that, you know, that isn't just like any old rundown building, but, it's the pillar of Black culture on campus. But speaking more towards the larger community, we've had a ton of alumni reach out to us via our Instagram page, say that, you know, we are in full support of what you guys are doing, and reach out to us if you guys need any help. We've had people who used to work in the Office of Belonging and Community reach out to us saying that, you know, we recently transferred departments and what you guys are doing is, you know, extreme, like, great work, and we commemorate you guys for, you know, fighting against community and belonging, and that just, you know, keep up the fight and things like that. So I think that we do have large support from the community at large. It's just like getting the message out there, because I think that once we get, you know, the message out there and people are able to understand what we are truly fighting for and why it is so important to, you know, continue this fight and advocate for the cultural center, then I think that is really going to help us, you know, gain momentum and be able to put some pressure on the UMD administration, and as well as, you know, those above the UMD administration, like the University of Maryland Board of Regents.
Mm. What you say, Elliot?
We got about 15 minutes left in the program. Let me sit in. In fact, let me do this. Let me go and see whether anybody want to say anything to the young folks. Let's go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia. Let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Oh, I'm just listening.
Okay. To all three of our guests, let me say this, because I think Brother Muhammad hit on something when he was talking about the policies dealing with the cultural center was racist and Zionist. And I think let me go up to New York City, and then we'll come back to what I want to say. Let's go up to New York City. New York.
Grace, peace, and truth to you, brothers. This is Brother Maurice out of the city of New York.
Yes, sir.
And to your young guests, I just wanted to say to them, first of all, I've spoken at the New Borough Cultural Center. New Borough means Freedom House. For most people, I'm sure that you probably already elaborated on that. But I go back to when Dr. Ziegler was down there, and I've spoken there three times, actually, to the students. And I've been, I just want to tell you how proud I am of each and every one of you in terms of the work that you're doing. We're not going to mention people's names, but I know several of the people that work at the Cultural Center, and I was concerned about it. And I made sure that when you posted your video on YouTube, via another avenue, I was able to air it on my show. I have a show called Black Men Screaming, and I aired it. And I was so proud of y'all with the work that y'all are doing. I was just wondering to myself, in terms of the situation, how do you young people think what's happening with the Trump administration and the number of black people that live in Prince George losing their jobs and their employment, how does that impact their attitude toward what's going on online with in terms of your struggle? Well, you have over 800,000 people, black men and women, losing their jobs, and that specifically is impacting the DMV. Do you wonder if that's something that you hear from students on campus? Are they even discussing that as an issue? Or is there, if you have family and friends that might be involved in that situation?
Yeah, I will say thank you very much for, you know, your kind words. I do appreciate it. Like the advocacy does get really draining sometimes, you know, but we hold each other down. We, you know, we push through. To answer your question, I think that's part of the reason of why this feels so overwhelming for a lot of people, because for a lot of people, this is impacting their families. This is impacting people that they know. Medicaid, you know, issues with food stamps, issues with Medicaid, cuts to funding. You know, I worked as a I worked as a psychiatric rehab counselor before, and I've seen these issues firsthand of how these, you know, these policies that for some people, it's a headline. For other people, it's their entire livelihood. You know what I mean? And we're running into a particularly difficult issue because you cannot deny the reality of people's struggles. You know, this person really maybe not have literally no time for themselves. They spend all their time working and going to school and, you know, they got kids and, you know, it's tough. And it puts us in a position where we're rolling a boulder up a hill. You know, like you kind of have to roll that boulder up that hill. And that's kind of like just how it's going to be. Like, unfortunately, that is how the situation is, you know. And, you know, it's utterly unfortunate. I definitely believe that it's all connected. And I think that's why they feel so comfortable, you know, because they feel like with the current climate, they feel like they're on the winning side, I guess. You know what I mean? Or they feel like they're backed up right now, you know. And I think that's all I'll say. I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Well, I know for a fact that there's several different events that have been going on, taking place around the country, and they've been complaining about they want young people, specifically between the ages of 19 to 39, to be actively involved, especially coming out of the black community and stuff. And I think part of the problem is that there's a messaging issue, because a lot of, you know, looking at the statistics and looking at Pew Research and other places talking about where do young black people communicate, where do they get their information and news, a lot of that stuff actually is online. And so we need to be promoting shows like Time for Awakening, some of the other shows that we know that are out here talking about our issues and bridging that quote-unquote a relationship gap, you know, because, you know, I see a lot of times that young people will say that they don't have a voice, but we want you to step forward. And Tume, who I love dearly or whatever, who was involved in several different struggles, said that the engine of any movement is young people. So don't think that we don't want you to step forward to the front. But we also want to be speaking to you in your ear, because there's certain things about this system you have never dealt with. You don't understand. It's not that we don't want you to leave, because we need you to take over. We can't fight the rest of the way. This is your time now. But we also want to let you know we got your back. And, you know, so this is what we're demonstrating today with Brother Richard and Brother Elliot and with myself, putting your information out there. Again, we love you. We want to encourage you to stay strong and to stay safe out there, because, you know, again, with that, not every folk like this, and not every skin folk is skin folk and stuff. And, you know, do what you need to do. But and the last thing I will say is this: when the sister was talking about the industrial, the Lockheed Martin or whatever, don't forget about Anthropic. Anthropic has a very big connection to the University of Maryland, and they're developing artificial intelligence and other means of monitoring not only military systems, but also monitoring individuals. That's one of the biggest struggles. I know a lot of young people talk about that online. So, I mean, I don't know if anybody wants to comment on that.
I actually could follow up on that. You know, it's with the Anthropic's relationship to the university,
like, well, what I do want to back up and say, you know, like, I appreciate you, like, offering that support, because a lot of the time, like, it does feel like there is nobody in your corner, or it kind of feels like you're doing it on your own, you know, and, you know, so all that support is appreciated, you know what I mean? And it's tough, but could you low-key repeat the last part of your question again? Because I feel like I was
talking about the connection with Anthropic. Anthropic, if people don't know, it deals with artificial intelligence, and they run a program called Claude. A lot of young people are deeply involved in using Claude, and Claude Anthropic spent like or received $30 billion for corporations and universities around the last year in terms of installing artificial intelligence. And Maryland, the University of Maryland, has a very incestuous relationship with them. They actually have been involved with developing technology on your campus. So I think it's very interesting to look at that as a fact that it can surveil you as individual, but it also is causing the issue of you being able to be employed within this system or whatever, because, you know, a lot of young people are having trouble finding jobs. I mean, I think they just had a couple of graduations where they had CEOs from these tech companies speaking, and young people, they started talking about AI, and young people started booing them and stuff, because they realize that when the system starts to kick in, there is no opportunity for anyone to come in as on an entry level and stuff. And so you're developing a system to unemploy people, but also to surveil people and to cause war.
I think actually Anissa would like to answer this question. Anissa, you can go ahead.
I was going to say, I think that, you know, dealing with AI, it's so tricky. It's such a hard relationship to manage, because on the one hand, you know, a corporation can decide not to use AI and they're going to get stuck in the past, or they're going to get left behind because all their other competitors are using AI. But on the other hand, they have to deal with, like, coming to terms with, you know, the environment, not only the environmental damage that AI causes, but, you know, the surveillance that AI does on us and the different types of bad things that AI can be used for. So I think that, I lost my train of thought. Sorry. I think that, you know, when discussing the relationship between AI and the University of Maryland and this kind of relationship that UMD has with AI and their constant push for integrating AI within different course loads and coursework as a whole, like introducing new classes like machine learning and how to use AI in, you know, workspaces and things like that, I think it's a tricky slope to manage, because, you know, at one point you want to be able to, you know, keep up with the times and stick and be able to, you know, learn how to use the technology. But then it's also understanding that, you know, this technology that you're learning about in class is ultimately going to, you know, take your job one day. So it's a really weird time that we live in, for sure.
Yeah, and if I can also connect it back to the cultural center, you know, I just wanted to say, like, that kind of emphasizes the issue that we're dealing with entirely of, you know, the money making the decisions, you know, for example, these large amounts of money coming in from weapons companies, from Zionists, from AI companies, you know, these are the people who are influencing the university to make its policies, to make its decisions, you know, and you know, the voices of activists like us are getting drowned out because of the money. You know, it's all about the capitalism. It's all about the money. It just runs everything, you know. And so because they have that money, they're able to exercise influence over the university in a way that's completely unfair and quite frankly, like, racist, you know, and all of the isms, like, to be honest. So, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm going to wrap this up, and I'm just going to say an old school thing. They say cream, right? Cash rules everything around me, and you're getting a first world experience with that. God bless you, all of y'all and stuff. Y'all stay strong, stay safe, stay blessed, and I'm out.
Thanks for your contribution.
Right, thank you, man. I appreciate you.
Listen, I want to thank all three of you for being with us to kind of bring us up on this situation that's fluent and ongoing. I wanted to say some things, but You know what? I'm going to wait because I want to see how these things play out. I want all three of you to kind of stay in touch with us because I want to have you back on to kind of give us updates. In fact, you know what? Before you go, Jade, Anissa, and Muhammad, talk about the list of demands. Just express them, and then I guess me and Richard can start winding down. Talk about the list of demands that you have confronted them with or going to confront them with.
Oh, I can do that. Originally, we went into this with 7 main demands. We wanted to first extend our Dr. Williams-Forson's contract through at least August of 2028 or instate her as a permanent director. But when we were made aware of how the hiring process fully works, we instead focused more so on just extending her interim position. We also wanted Dr. Williams-Forson to have the first right of refusal for the permanent director role. So that was our second demand. We also wanted to cancel the national search immediately, especially with the current pressure from the administration and the way it's looking right now. We thought it wouldn't be in the center's best interest to start the national search right now and just let have our interim director there to do the work until things have calmed down. Our fourth demand was to establish a formal student and community evaluation process that requires the Office of Belonging and Community to seek input from NIMBRU ambassadors, staff, and program participants at the center. Our fifth demand was that we wanted to conduct an independent review of the Office of Community and Belongings Oversight Practices, because it is with our understanding that if we are facing this kind of mistreatment, it's likely being faced by other centers on campus. Six, we also wanted the university to commit to a concrete funded plan with a publicly shared timeline and budget for renovations and updates to NIMBRU Culture Center's physical infrastructure. What we've been dealing with for the past couple years, even for the ambassadors before us, is that admin would promise us certain things would get done to the center, but then when we come back, they'd say, oh, never mind, plans change, you know. They've been saying that our multipurpose room, like the NPR that people use on the regular, has been supposed to have been fixed. But every time they're all like, oh, we're meeting with so-and-so. Oh, the plans have been pushed back. And they haven't been willing to commit or at least state on the record saying this is the concrete plan that we will be going with. So we want them to commit to a concrete funded plan. And seven, during our meetings with both President Pines and VP Dodge, we wanted them to publicly reaffirm the university's commitment to the NIMBRU Culture Center. During both meetings, we asked President Pines and VP Dodge to release a public saying that if they couldn't do anything immediately right now, we asked them to at least release a public statement saying that we have heard the issues of the students and we are committed to doing this. But both parties denied releasing a public statement, especially in our meeting with President Pines. He stated that if he did one for one group, he'd have to do it for all groups, and that we're just one of hundreds of groups that reach out to him asking for a statement. So those are our main 7 demands as of right now.
Now, is there a time limit where you're supposed to meet with them or they have to give you an answer on what you're putting forth?
Currently, there was different timelines that were thrown around as we've released different statements and met with them on different occasions. But currently, we're looking to get a statement from them and have a concrete meeting by the end of this month, before either by the end of this May or early June that we're trying. So we're looking at around a 2 to 3 week deadline.
Okay, good. If you all don't mind, I'd like you to come back on and give us an update on the progress of what has been going on. That'll kind of give me an opportunity to kind of weigh things before because I wanted to mention some things to you guys, but I'll kind of let things play out first and then let you put in the work that you want to do. And just keep in mind, just as the brother out of New York City just stated, that even though me and Richard are not there in Prince George County or in Maryland, we're in your corner. We'll do what we can to avail the microphone to you activists and others. If you know some of the other activists that you want to get involved, that you would like to be involved, that the door is open to you to utilize this platform to kind of get some messages out.
Thank you.
But I'll be looking forward to you getting back in touch with us so to give us an update on what has happened.
No problem at all. Weird. And for those,
Go ahead.
Thank you so much for that. And for those listening, if you do want to stay up to date with what we've been doing, like at this, like we, the ambassadors, have been doing, feel free to follow us on our Instagram at noom.ambassadors. So that's N-Y-U-M dot, the word ambassadors on Instagram. Please make sure to follow us. We also have our official email. So if you want to email us, it's just nimbruambassadors. So that's N-Y-U-M, the word ambassadors, at gmail.com. For those who have questions or want to learn more about how they can help us, or if they want to follow us on our journey, please, please do. Every like, every share, every comment helps.
Okay. Okay. Sounds good. Any closing statements besides you just made one, Sister Jade? Any closing statements for Manisa or Brother Muhammad?
Yeah. I would just like to thank you again for, you know, giving us a platform to, spread the word and share what's been going on our campus. You know, a lot of what we've been doing has kind of felt like we've been, you know, speaking to an echo chamber, and it hasn't been able to reach that many people. So being able to be guests on your show has been an incredible experience, but also really rewarding, knowing that, you know, we're getting some more ears and more people will be able to learn about our cause, follow us and support us and, you know, rally with us as we try to protect our cultural center. So thank you very much for having us today.
No, thank you for your work. Go ahead, Brother Muhammad.
Thank you. Well, my closing statement is, man, to all the people out there, just realize that the algorithm is not your friend. Please be wary of where you're getting your information from. Please be wary that you are actively being programmed every day by the algorithm. If you're not choosing the content, you know, you got to think about who's choosing it for you. And secondly, I would just want to say, replug the Instagram again, NYUM.ambassadors is the Instagram, NYUM.ambassadors. We're going to be coming out with some email templates soon for anybody who's interested to be able to send emails to Maryland State Delegate and the Regents Board. And, you know, we have copy paste emails and stuff like that. And we have our hashtag, which is #ProtectNarenborough. So if you could repost anything or whatever post off of our Instagram, repost it with the hashtag Protect Narren Borough, you know, that would be great. And then we have those email templates that we're going to post soon. And anybody who wants to send an email directly to the Maryland State Delegates, the Regents Board, and President Pines and Dr. Dodge can do so. So, yeah.
All right. Richard, you want to say something?
Other than thank y'all. I mean, y'all don't know. You know, me and Ellie were talking before. I'm looking at, you know, those, y'all are the organizers that we've been looking for. What you're doing now is the training day, the training ground. As you've seen in this discussion from me, as I've been learning from you, that what you're going through is something broader that's happening in our communities or amongst our people in general.
Yes.
And I'm glad to see that y'all are taking the initiative. Everybody's there, but only few took the initiative. And I hope that you take to conscious that you are in the training mode, regardless of where you go in your life towards continuing this here. We can go into later what this is.
All right. Thank you all for being with us. We'll talk soon.
All right, bye. Thank you.
All right.
Bye. Thank you all so much for having us. Bye.
All right.
Take care.
Richard.
Yes.
that was a good conversation. You know, this attack on these college campuses, man, you know, Ricky Jones kind of talked about it from a professor's point of view, you know, when he was on with us. You hear James Lance Taylor, he's talking about it from a professor's point of view of what's going on. And you've heard other professors come on and talk about it. But I'm glad to have the students come on and talk about it from the way they're viewing it. And that activism, that fighting spirit, you know, they're looking at it from their peers and they see it a little bit differently than we do, Richard.
Right.
But they see the distractions. The distractions are there.
Right.
They talk about the algorithms of, you know, what they're searching online. It'll just keep on feeding them those type of things and take their mind away from doing positive things. This is deep, Richard. It's really deep.
And you know, when I seen the numbers or the money that, you know, that's being donated, you know, one thing is clear, you know, like when we're talking about cultural institutions, like, you know, the center itself, you don't see black individuals donating. And I'm not saying it's a negative. I'm just trying to point out, you know, a unfair comparative effect, you know, that just imagine if that, you know, donations were coming in to upgrade and continuing that infrastructure there to be a part of the cultural development of those students that come there, what that would mean to the broader community.
Yeah, you're right. Listen, before we leave tonight, let me get the lineup on time for an Awakening Media. Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshi. Always interesting topics, dialogue, and guests on African Perspectives. It's Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on Monday evenings, Our Story, live from New Orleans, Louisiana, with Bob Wes Johnson and Brother Johnny. That's Our Story. Monday evenings from 7 to 9, and then they double back on Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m. Our Story with Bobby West Johnson on Thursdays. The door is always open for Mississippi on the Move. Brother Patrick Lumumba, Sister Krista Denise, Brother Rodney Lowe, Brother Dove Sack, four hosts, one mission, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. Mississippi on the Move. Sundays, Pinckney to Pinckney, 5 to 6, and Time for an Awakening from 6 until. Before we ended, Richard, I don't know whether you was able to catch Our Story Monday. And Brother Wes and Brother Johnny had a former lawmaker on with them talking about, because that's ground zero where this whole case started and what's happening down there with black elected officials and how some of them is kind of turning on one another. Instead of focusing their energy on people that's attacking them, it's really it's not a strange dynamic, but it's something that our people need to hear, and that's why it's, you know, media is important. Black media, conscious black media is important. That's all I'll say.
Right.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back next week, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school. They seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah. Children. Soon it will be their turns to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. Thank you.
teach school. If we know, all we say we know about the problem.
Children, to save the children.